Good morning, everybody, and Happy New Year. This is our first meeting of 2008. This meeting is called to order. Before proceeding with any business, I believe Mr. Cook has a statement to make.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the Office of Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551, Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I would like for this fact to be noted in the official record of the meeting. And also, Mr. Chairman, before we proceed, I think while we've got everybody here, I would like to mention that the commission meeting, which is usually held in April, just because of the calendar shift and all that stuff, has been changed to the last week of March this year. This information is posted on our website, but I wanted to bring it to everyone's attention so that we can start getting the word out now that our next commission meeting will be March 26th, 27th. Yeah, thank you, sir.
Yeah, you should have that. Thank you, Bob. I'd also like to, since we're a pretty good group here today, introduce Carter Smith. Carter, if you'd stand up for a moment. And Carter is going to be the new executive director of Texas Parks and Wildlife starting next Monday, isn't that correct?
28.
Yeah, congratulations. And we're proud to have Carter coming aboard, and he's going to sit in today and tomorrow and watch how all this goes. We're good. We're smooth. Bob keeps us on track. Bob and Carol, actually. Right, Carol? And anyway, and then Carter will be starting next week, so glad you're here. I have asked Commissioner Brown to take over as chair of the Finance Committee, and Commissioner Brown, Robert, will you please call your committee to order? You want this little deal?
I'd like to have that
power. There you go. Get a feel for it, will you? Yeah, right. I think we need a bigger one, actually.
No, it's kind of sissy.
Yeah, right.
I'd like to call the Finance Committee order. The first order of business is the approval of the previous committee meeting minutes, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
So moved.
Second.
Got a motion by Commissioner Friedkin. And a second by Commissioner Hickson. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. Next item of business is the committee item number one, which is land and water plan update. Mr. Cook.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Our internal audit shop is staffed with 16 new auditors, and they are conducting audits around the state and our state parks. They've completed 9 audits that are currently being reviewed, and the reports are expected to be sent to the state parks management towards the end of this month. The field work on 8 additional audits has just been completed, and those are lined up to be reviewed, and another 11 audits are starting this week. These audits are a good tool to let us know how we are, you know, what our status is as far as complying with the recommendations of the state auditor's report and our new fiscal policies. The director, our director of internal audit, Dennis O'Neill, recently retired, and we are currently in the process of selecting a new director for our internal audit group. On another item, all members have been selected for the Sunset Advisory Commission, and they have begun the sunset process. Some of our folks went down and sat in on just kind of an introductory meeting about 10 days ago. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Department is scheduled for the second tier of reviews. They have a number of state agencies that are being reviewed this go-around. We are in the what's called the second tier, which I will say I think is probably a good thing. We've met our primary staff that we'll be working with. We've worked with them before. They're good folks. We know them. They know us. So I anticipate that will go well. And this second tier of reviews is expected to start their come out and do their introductory thing, start their field work about mid-May. So we're lined up to go with our sunset report. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Cook. The committee item number 2 is the implementation of recommendations by the State Auditor's Office of State Parks Financial Processes. And Scott Worlk is going to make the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, for the record, my name is Scott Borough, Deputy Executive Director, Operations. Here today to give you our update on how we're implementing our state auditor's recommendations that were asked of us in the last session, at the end of the last session. I've got this new little machine here today. I've been instructed on how to use it, if I can remember how to go. As a little bit of history, since we've got a few new commissioners, I'm going to spend a little bit more time on this than I will probably in future meetings. Back in the late 05 budget cycle, we made some cuts to operations in state parks, where we reduced operations at 52 state parks around the state. We reduced staff by 70-plus folks out there in the field, and that came really on the heels of some budget cuts historically in Fund 64, which is the fund that supports state parks. The agency, however, in those budget cuts in previous bienniums, did not really cut the budget of state parks. We cut the budgets of the support divisions, including infrastructure and communications and administrative resources, to try to insulate the field operations from the cuts as much as possible. So the real phenomena that hurt us in late 05 was that escalating costs were not being kept up with. The budget really in state parks was relatively flat. If you look at the historical picture back to about 04, you see a flat budget, but you see costs climbing dramatically, which then resulted in ultimately the cuts to state park operations in late 05. We went back to the legislature in 07 and asked for some financial help there, and we were very appreciative of the legislature's response. They ultimately gave us some additional funding to the tune of about $7.2 million a year for additional staff, about $5.7 million a year in additional operating funds, $4 million a year in minor repair, $3 or $4 million a year in equipment. So it was very helpful to put us back on track. We have reopened the huge majority of the parks that were partially closed. We did not, by the way, close any parks completely. We limited hours, we cut back the number of days, and those kind of things to try to make a minimum impact on our constituents out there. Prior to the state auditor's office coming in to look at us, we had already done internal audits, which did identify some of the problems that we were experiencing in state parks, primarily as a result of not having enough staff to do what we needed to do. But we took those seriously, and in 2006 and 2007, the SAO folks decided they were going to do this audit. They came in March of 2007, or completed their study in March. They came in actually in December, January, February, and issued the report in March, which resulted in findings that amounted to 48 significant recommendations. There were also a series of riders that were related to the audit, and so we internally decided to roll those riders into our response. So what we have is actually about 52 issues that we were dealing with, 48 that were specifically in the SAO recommendations, and another four riders which related to those recommendations. Those 52 or so, or 48 or 52, depending on how you want to look at it, recommendations were classified into four broad categories. I will tell you that we are making and have made very substantial progress on all of those recommendations. We have submitted all of our reports. There's a number of reporting requirements, quarterly reports and annual reports, that require us to report progress against what we're doing. Those reports have all been turned in on time, and in fact, the last quarterly report, which was due the end of December, we turned in, December the 31st, we turned in on December the 15th, so we're getting a little bit ahead of the curve now and able to get these responses in ahead of time. We have met several times with the SAO and LBB staff, most recently about 8 or 10 days ago, to review progress and to look at their satisfaction with our reports and our processes. And I would say, in general, they're satisfied with where we're heading. They have made a couple of recommendations, which we are taking seriously, and we continue to work closely with the LBB staff and the SAO staff to get on down the road with this. We are on schedule to complete all 48 of the major recommendations on time. And we do track these hours very closely, and to date, we have had over 40,000 man-hours of staff time invested in resolving these recommendations.
Scott, how does this tie into the sunset? Right.
Well, the sunset, there is a relationship. I'm sure as we go through the sunset process, the sunset committee will be looking at our compliance with recommendations both from this audit and from previous audits, which we've always taken seriously and always have done, a good job of responding to. So I suspect they will look at that. I don't anticipate any problems there, but I'm sure we'll take a look at it. As I said earlier, there were four broad categories of recommendations. The first was to improve the accuracy of park visitation reporting and maximize state park revenue. We knew, in fact, in our earlier internal audits, we had identified counting visitors as a problem for our state parks division. We had a lot of antiquated equipment. We had equipment that varied from site to site, and you'll hear some of the specifics about that as I move on. But this was an issue that related to park revenues and was very important to us and very important to the SAO and the legislature for us to take a look at. I reported last meeting a whole suite of successes that we had there. I'm not going to re-articulate those. Certainly would be glad to resend that presentation if you're interested. Since then, though, we've continued to make progress against those recommendations. We've implemented new visitation procedures, and these are procedures that have been vetted through our Administrative Resources Division with Mary Fields and her staff. We appreciate that help and support. Kim Ludicky in that new shop that was created in Administrative Resources, as you will recall, and her 10 or 11 staff have been very instrumental in working hand-in-hand with the State Parks Division to try to put together these processes in a way that's acceptable to the State Auditor and the Legislative Budget Board. For example, we've installed standardized traffic counters. Just so you'll know, we're counting visitation in state parks during normal operating hours with an actual counter. We're taking a head count. There's not going to be much question about how many people come into the parks while we're open anymore. One of the issues, though, is how we're going to estimate visitation that comes in after hours. And one of the problems we had before is that we had a dozen or more different kinds of car counters. We had different procedures at every park about how to use the car counters. So we simply have gone back in and established procedures that every park uses, and they use the same kind of equipment. So they're doing the same thing park to park to park, which gives us some credible numbers. That also makes it easier when staff are going to move from park to park to know what the procedures are and not get clumsy in implementing the procedures because the procedures are homogenous across the different parks. We're conducting regular surveys of our visitors in the parks, and visitation, I think, is going to be pretty dramatically improved. Our ability to estimate visitation will be dramatically improved in the wake of these new processes.
What do you mean regular surveys?
Now, we have folks that are going in after hours and surveying the folks that come into the park. One of the issues you always have in a park, for example, somebody may just drive in at night and drive through the loop and drive out. So we're actually going into the park after hours on a random but a statistical basis and looking at who actually lands in the park, basically, who's actually there, and making sure that those people have paid either through somebody coming around the next morning to collect fees from them or in some cases where they pay through some other mechanism. So it's just a way to go in and validate the visitation procedures through survey activities. Standardized discount fees and waivers were a big issue before. We had many parks doing many different things in terms of discounts. We do think it's appropriate to have reasonable discounts for children, for example, and youth groups that are coming into the parks. We do sometimes waive those fees either in total or partially. But we didn't have a systematic way of applying those discounts across the systems. We now do that. I believe the discounts can be either 20, 50, or 100% discounts. There's a limited number of discounts, is my point, and they're applied consistently, and they're overseen and approved through the chain of command at the park, and they come back to the AR division so that they can validate whether those are being done appropriately. So these standardized processes, including fees, including the way we count visitors, have been very important for us to be able to get a handle on these financial controls.
What's the determining factor there? Is it it's a Boy Scout troop that qualifies?
There are parameters
and agencies that would qualify. How do you apply that?
We have some standard policies in place, and I could ask Mr. Dabney to come up, or I could get you that information.
You just get it, but
all right, we will forward you that information. There are some standardized processes that the local staff have to go through, and they have to also get approval from their chain of command. It's just not kind of willy-nilly anybody gives any discount
right.
they want.
Right.
I think one of the things that's important, Commissioner, is that now when they give a discount, there must be a record of who it was and why it was.
Yeah.
And so that we can develop some of those parameters around, because I think the park manager has to have some discretion when the vehicle pulls up,
right.
And so we're trying to meet the requirements of the report and yet still serve our customers as they need to be served. So.
I don't want to imply that we didn't have processes in place before. I think Mr. Cook's comments are very valid. A lot of what we got criticism for is that we had poor documentation of the processes that we had. So making the processes homogenous across the system and good documentation were probably the two key elements, along with revising some processes that need to be revised. Last but not least, accomplishment in under Section 1 was we are actively conducting analyses of potential revenue-generating opportunities, and those vary everything from the kinds of things you rent out in a park to when you're open, when you staff the front gates, and those kinds of things. But that there are active analyses going on to try to look at potential new revenue sources for the parks. The second major category of recommendations were to improve the effectiveness of management and operation of state parks. Once again, I'm going to go over the new accomplishments, not the ones that had already been accomplished. We're providing enhanced monthly budget analysis. There are two new positions in the state park budget which help parks provide budget analysis and historical research relative to budget utilization. We work closely with the Administrative Resource Division on a monthly basis to look at how close we're coming to projected revenues and those kinds of things. Probably one of our biggest remaining work packages, if you will, from the SAO recommendations is the analysis and review and ultimate implementation of a zero-based budget model. We're well down the road there. There are several different deliverables which ultimately culminate in the process being completed. We have gone out and looked nationwide at the industry standard zero-based budget models, and just for your edification, the bottom line is there is we're actually looking at every work unit in a state park, how many times a day the bathroom has to be cleaned, how many minutes it takes to clean it, how much equipment it takes to do that. Same thing with lawns, how often do you have to mow them, what kind of equipment do you have, how many hours or minutes a day does that take. So we're going work unit by work unit, park by park, and identifying what it takes to take care of that park. That's what the zero-based budget is. We've got a model out there that's been used by other states. Most recently, the state of Oregon, for example, has used this same model to identify the needs for the state park. And I'll tell you in a minute how this relates to some of the other riders, which I think are going to be important as we roll into the next session. The third major category of recommendations was to improve the consistency of cost estimating processes, ensure proper prioritization of capital improvement and repair needs. You may recall that we came to the Commission back in August with a list of prioritization criteria for major capital projects. I will articulate again the fact that the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department has a long and successful track record in implementing capital projects. We have for the last decade been able to sustain about a $20 to $22 million a year expenditure rate. There is good evidence that we are effective and efficient in expending those dollars. There's also some misunderstanding about the timing about how those projects gets delivered. It's not something that happens as quickly as in the private sector. It is important, I think, to say, though, that we do have a track record of being successful at expending those dollars. We have never had problems spending our dollars in capital projects. Having said that, there were recommendations about establishing criteria. Obviously, the legislature, as well as ourselves, are very interested in making sure that the parks are not only accessible to the people of Texas, but safe and effective for their purposes for recreation. Some of the major accomplishments we've accomplished in the last period of time since I reported to you before, we have gone out and done extensive training both with the state parks staff and the infrastructure staff on this new prioritization model that we're using. How do you prioritize projects? One thing I want to take a moment here, because it's going to be important that the commission understands this, is that we have several categories of prioritization that you approved back in August. One is health and safety. One is regulatory issues. Another is what we call business continuity, which is our effort to make sure we don't see a decrease in revenues and, when possible, try to increase revenues. There is some confusion about the health and safety criteria. It is not an emergency. Those criteria are used for projects that we are planning. We don't plan for emergencies. Emergencies happen. We deal with them immediately. So some people take that health and safety criteria to mean something is imminent, somebody's going to get hurt, there's some kind of situation which puts our customers at danger, and that's a misperception. what health and safety is tagged to is the potential down the road for a project, if it goes unaddressed, to ultimately become an emergency and to ultimately create some health risk to the public. It is not imminent. If it's imminent, it's classified as an emergency. We take care of it immediately. We close the facility. We get to work on it with emergency funds. This process that I'm describing to you is for planning out into the future about how to spend the funds. But so just as you move down the road, be aware if you get some feedback that we have gotten this feedback recently. Why would you do a business continuity project before you would do a health and safety project? Well, the answer is some health and safety projects are not going to be a problem for 5 or 7 years. They're just there because we know under industry standards that a roof has to be replaced every 20 years. And so 4, 5, 7 years out, we start thinking about that. How are we going to do that 5 years out? Doesn't mean the roof's going to fall down in the next 5 years. In the meantime, we're trying to balance the legislature and our own interest in increasing revenues. So there may be another project that if we went out and did quickly, we could increase revenues. We would still deal with that health and safety issue later. We are required under the some of the riders to submit a variance report on our capital construction projects so that when a project comes in at 10% higher or lower than it was projected, we report that. We're required to do that on a regular basis. We have, since the last commission meeting, submitted 3 of those variance reports, which have been accepted by the LBB and the SAO, so we are on target with our reporting. Last and probably most importantly for all of us, including the legislature and our oversight organizations, which is the fourth category, which is to address the financial control weaknesses in state park operations. In fact, I've already described a lot of those activities in the context of the other recommendations, but we have some new accomplishments. I'm sorry, lagging behind, and there we go. We have some additional accomplishments in this final category, which are important. We have implemented a comprehensive fiscal control policy and procedures to guide the state park staff. I'll talk a little bit more about that. We are in the process of moving towards an automated system that will reduce some of the workload on the staff, but right now these are manual processes. As Mr. Cook reported in the beginning of this committee meeting under the land and water updates, one of the requirements was for us to hire 16 new auditors for the parks. We have done so. Those folks, 14 of them at least, are field-based. The other two here in Austin, I believe, helping coordinate. They have completed quite a few initial audits. The early audits, as you might expect, found some technical problems with our completing some of the financial control processes. We've immediately taken those back to the field staff and planned additional training. We believe the second wave will show significant improvement, and we'll continue to address those things as we move down the road. We have a long-term training plan for park management, which had already actually been implemented prior to the SAO recommendations, but we continue to move down that road with managing park operations. I think we've had a couple of hundred staff go through that process already. Very intensive week-long or two-week-long, in some cases, training process. The audit program is moving forward rapidly. We do intend to go back to key parks and re-audit again if we find some issues in a park that causes concern. And I will say that we haven't seen any trends. That's one of the things we look for in these early audits. Do we see some trend that indicates some significant problem? Really has been not so much trends, but just a whole hodgepodge of different kind of technical issues, which you might expect with a brand new system with manual out there, filling out the forms correctly, making sure you fill out the right form. We are particularly sensitive to any attitude issues we run into, which we have not run into many. If we've got folks out there that don't want to do what they need to do, we are dealing with that directly and immediately. That's not happened except in extremely rare cases. For the most part, the park staff have been very cooperative and understand the importance of this financial control exercise. We are providing quarterly revisions to the site-specific revenue goals. I mentioned that a little bit earlier, working closely with Mary Field staff and administrative resources. We're trying to, on a quarterly basis, come back and determine how close we are at guessing what our revenues will be and at looking at those additional revenue sources that I described earlier to see if there are ways that we can enhance revenues appropriately. We are required under Rider 23 to monitor health and safety capital repairs weekly, which we are doing. It's a big workload for both the infrastructure and park staff. I think this was partly in the confusion between what health and safety and emergency is, but we are on a regular basis. Those projects which we identify as health and safety, we're monitoring those every week to make sure that they haven't become an emergency, and if they do, we take the response which I described earlier. We are also required, and this is a redundant, but I wanted to let you know that both in the recommendations and in Rider 27, we were required to provide quarterly adjustments to our revenue projections. That is being done. And we have, and this is redundant, we have sent in our last quarterly report 2 weeks ahead of time. So we're, like I said, I think we're getting ahead of the curve a little bit there. We've submitted the 3 10% variance reports. Probably the first largest work package remaining are riders 30 and 31, and these are riders that which direct us to hire a private vendor to look at the impact of expenditures of capital dollars. So the idea is, let's go out there and figure out, is there any additional revenue opportunity when you spend capital dollars to fix up state parks? We don't think there's going to be a dramatic revenue increase. We are certainly open. This is a private vendor who's working independently. They work closely with us, but they're doing the study independently. What we believe we will see, and what we're hearing at least initially, is that the report will probably suggest what you logically would assume, which is fixing up existing infrastructure usually doesn't mean a whole lot of new revenues. It just means you're not going to go in the tank with your old revenues because your facilities aren't falling apart. There may be, though, in some cases where you've got an opportunity to do something new or to build some new infrastructure, there may be some revenue opportunities which we are serious about trying to identify and squeeze out as best we can. That particular report is due the end of March, March the 31st. We're on target. We do believe the deliverable will happen on time, and that report will go to the LVB and the SAO March the 31st. In fact, those vendors, I believe, are going to be downtown next week to brief our oversight committees and our major groups downtown as to what they're doing and make sure they're involved all along the way. The Rider 31, which is related to Rider 30, and it's being done, by the way, by the same vendor, asked us to submit a work plan and to identify what a high-quality park system would look like. We have submitted the work plan as required to SAO and LBB. The final deliverable, which is this report that comes from the vendor, is due October the 31st, and it will identify what they believe a high-quality state park system is and what it would take to get there, well, both in terms of expenditures and in terms of acquisitions and those kinds of things. This will be basically a study that says if you really want a high-quality state park, you're going to need to do this, this, and this, and here's what it will cost you.
You've hired that vendor?
Yes, sir. They're on board.
And they've done this kind of work?
Yes, sir.
Elsewhere around the country?
Yes, sir. They have a good reputation. We spend a lot of time looking around the country. It's a group called Pros Consulting that's done this for several other states. They have a high credibility. We've got good recommendations from other state oversight agencies, other state legislative bodies, and those kind of things. So this is a group that's done this and knows what they're doing.
PROS, P-R-O-S.
P-R-O-S.
You'll have, I assume they'll work with you closely. There's a lot of input that they receive from you.
Absolutely. In fact, they are out in the field right now, Mr. Chairman. They are working closely with the state park staff. We meet with them here at headquarters with the senior executive staff once every month or so. So we're in close contact, but we're also sensitive to the fact that this is an independent study. We're not trying to drive the conclusions. We're just trying to be cooperative and provide information.
I really appreciate getting this information. I know it's important. Coming out of the construction business, I realize there are other items dealing with our state parks that we addressed during the last legislature, and the legislature was kind enough to go along with practically everything we sent down there to them. But with regard to the repairs that are very, very necessary in our state park system, and they are repairs that we took to the legislature in gaining their favor. Can you give me a little report? Give the commission a little report. Is what's coming up out of the ground? If you understand what I'm talking about.
Well, I think I do, Commissioner. Let me give it a shot. You can let me know if I'm not going where you want me to.
Okay.
The bottom line is, when the legislature first gave us this money and appropriated the money to us, they asked for some of these riders to be completed before the money was actually given to us to spend.
Mm-hmm.
Riders 30 and 31 were key examples of that. They basically said, as soon as these studies are done, where we get some indication of how the expenditures are going to affect revenues and how a quality state park would look, then we will allow you to start spending that money. And they actually set a date for us to have that done by the end of September. When we went out to the private sector and said we need this study done, the feedback we got from the private sector was the timing did not work. They could not get the study done by September. So we went back
to... We basically gave them... we went out within 90 days of the end of the legislature and started...
We went out sooner than that, actually.
Yeah.
We went out immediately.
Well, I was going to say, Scott, why don't you walk people through when the legislature ended and then they wanted that report actually done and back by September, which was 90 days.
That's correct. And the vendor community said that was impossible.
Yeah.
And we were very appreciative of the fact that LBB and SAO heard that message. We went back to them and asked for an extension based on the feedback we got from the private sector, which said that March the 31st was the earliest they could accomplish it. And the LBB and the SAO concurred with our request for the waiver to give us until March the 31st so that the private sector could have time. So that's kind of how that timing happened. Now, the reality is, once that report goes in at the end of March, we still, and assuming it's approved and accepted by the LBB and the SAO, which we're assuming because we in good faith are moving forward, we then have to still go through several other steps within the state structure to get the money and start doing projects with it. We have to go to the Texas Public Finance Authority. They don't meet every month. They have a, they meet several times a year, much as this body does. Once the TPFA approves it, we have to go before the Bond Review Board, which doesn't meet every month. It has a periodic schedule. And so the fact is, we don't expect to get the cash to start these capital construction projects until around September the 1st, this next September the 1st. Which means by the time you go out for a design, which takes 30 to 90 days under the state process to get a design consultant.
You might remind everybody, you can't go out for design until you have the money.
Cash. That's correct.
Okay. I've had to go through all this, John. I think that's what John's trying to point out.
The point is, it's not as quick a process.
I want it on the record. I don't want somebody coming back to us 7 months.
I'm just asking Scott to kind of clarify the way the system
saying,
works.
You haven't done anything.
Yeah, exactly.
That's exactly the reason.
So to clarify how it works is the way the law reads, the stats read, or the regs read.
Under the current legislation and existing state rules, I mean, we have to, first of all, meet the rider requirements, which we intend to do in March. We then have to go through the state process of getting in front of the Texas Public Finance Authority and the Bond Review Board. Once the money is issued to us, the bonds are issued, and the money comes back to the agency, we can then begin to start the process of selecting a design vendor, which typically under state regulatory competitive issues, you have to go out to bid, you have to get RFPs and those kind of things. It could take up to 90 days. Then the design process typically takes anywhere from 6 months to 9 months, sometimes even a year, depending on the size and complexity of the project. So before you're in construction, it will probably be towards the end of the next session, and that's when the money really gets spent, is when you get into construction. Typically, the design phase takes about 15% of your dollars. The other 85% get expended late in the curve for construction for obvious reasons when you start putting bricks and mortar on the ground.
Now, let me ask you another question. Is there a good possibility that we're going to be going back to the legislature and asking them, we've got this that we didn't get done 2 years ago. Now we're asking you to assist us in doing this.
Well, I guess that's up to you, ladies and gentlemen, to tell us what you want us to do.
Well,
the bottom line is, I will say,
I can answer that.
God's being nice, but you don't want to.
That's the reality of it.
Yes or no?
Well, let me put it this way. Historically, the agency has, in the 8 years I've been here, gone to the legislature in every session and asked for, and by and large has been successful at acquiring new funding, even in the light of the reality of the expenditure curve we have. So we've gone back every session and said we need more money. The fact is, we've identified $400 million of backlog. We received some $67 million in this last session. So there's still a big gap there to meet our needs. There's still a $300-plus million gap. My recommendation to the commission and Mr. Smith this next session is going to be we go back and ask for more money. And I don't feel hesitant because we will spend the $67 million and we will spend it right. We have a history of spending money historically. The fact that it rolls over from year to year, yes, it aggravates certain folks because it looks like they're not spending it as fast as they want. But the fact is we have a track record of spending money. We did it when we got $70 million the first year I was here. It took us 4 or 5 years to spend those dollars, but we're done. The old dollars are expended, and that's the good news. As we go into the next session, the only dollars left on the table are going to be the dollars we got in this last session. All those previous bond issues, legal minds speaking, are going to be completely expended and encumbered. So I don't think we should be shy about going and asking for more money. I think we've been effective at spending these dollars. I think given the constraints we have under the state system, we've been pretty quick about it. We've been effective. We've been cautious to get the right kinds of things done under the right time frame.
Well, we all know that Steve and Walt and you and the entire department is doing a great job, but I just wanted to get it out where everybody could know about it, what we're going to be faced with January the 3rd of 09.
That's probably true, and I guess my wrap-up comment is probably the same thing past commissions have experienced each time they've gone back to the legislature.
But we know legislators tend to turn over for various reasons.
Yes,
so sometimes it's a re-education process.
It's complex. There's no doubt. Yeah. It's not a simple system.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think one of our goals this year, in other words, before the legislative session starts in January 09, is to spend some time with everybody from the governor's office, lieutenant governor's office, speaker of the House, on down to key committees, committee heads, how to say it the right way, making sure they understand that before we walk in January 09, asking for the next 2 years out. So that's going to be one of my goals, Carter Smith's goals as we go forward, is make sure that we do that. Scott's already doing that. Gene's already doing that on an ongoing basis. And so I think that's going to be a key part of my job, particularly driving that.
I'll try to wrap up quickly here, folks, and I promise in the future, unless directed otherwise, I'll keep these much briefer than this because I think we're nearing completion, to be honest with you. One of the things that's probably just as important to us as the recommendations that fell out of the SAO report and the associated riders is the agency's ongoing effort to try to automate a system that will track the kind of financial control issues that we're now having to do manually. Those manual controls eat up a ton of time for the State Parks Division out in the field. They also require a lot of time from their field staff in terms of monitoring and auditing those activities as they flow back into the agency. We have gone out and requested from the private sector some requests for proposals to put together an automated package that would do many of those financial controls for us, as well as our reservation system, which we already have and works pretty well, but we need an integrated system. Within the last month, received seven different proposals to our request. Gene McCarty, Mary Fields, George Rios, and Walt Dabney as a team with their staffs have been reviewing those requests. I think we have narrowed that down to two or three vendors that we believe could perform, going through some more due diligence to look at their financial capability, their technical capability, and their ability to meet the operational needs of the state parks. We hope to next month select a vendor who would then move down the road with those three prime divisions, AR, Administrative Resources, Information Technology, and State Parks, to put together this automated system. Our goal is to have that system in place prior to the session, November or December, at the end of this year. We believe that's possible, but it's aggressive. So we're not making any promises, but we wanted you to know we are pushing as hard as possible to have that process, that system in place, either prior to or very early in the session. And once again, I think George Rios would be nervous at me making that promise, but I think we are potentially going to try to get there. I didn't miss clips of it. last but not least, I just wanted to summarize the three major remaining work tasks. The first is, of course, the completion of the zero-based budget exercise, which I described is due on October 31st, so we will be working on that on an ongoing basis until end of the next fiscal year. And then the completion of the Rider 30 and 31 studies by the private vendor. The first one is the one that triggers our capital money, which we hope to have happen shortly after March the 31st when that report is turned in. The second is this definition of a high-quality park, and I think that'll be interesting as we go into the session and maybe think about asking for new money. The money that we received last time around basically bailed us out and allowed us to reopen the parks and get those parks back into minimal operating condition. It did not give us enough money to make those high-quality state parks, and I assume that was the rationale between this particular about this particular rider. What would it take in addition to make this a real high-quality park system? So it'd be interesting to see what those two studies fall out of those two studies. And then last but not least, and really probably the most important for us operationally, is this automated system that would allow us to start being more efficient in the way we use our human resources to track financial controls in the State Parks Division. With that, I would welcome any questions, and glad to answer.
Scott, I would like to say that you and your team have done an outstanding job in this whole process, and you're to be complimented on the work you've done.
Any questions? On the new system, when you say new, you're talking about new to us. Now, you're not necessarily going out and trying to invent a whole new system for state parks. You can look at across the nation what others have done, benchmark, et cetera.
We have looked across the nation, and surprisingly, there's not much out there. I mean, all other states are either in the same boat we are in or they're in the water. They're worse off than we are. There is not a canned...
Even the national park system.
Even the national park system does not have an integrated system. Now, I'm not going to pretend to be the technical folks here, but what I'm hearing, I believe, is that there are some packages out there that would provide a basic platform that we then may be able to tweak a little bit to get what we need to. Now, there again, you can sense my lack of technical expertise. Just, I say tweak, I'm sure George would have a better word for it. But bottom line is, we're not going to start from scratch, I don't believe, but I do think we're going to need to customize something that we would blow off the shelf.
I think it's safe to say Mary's folks and the various ones, George's folks working on this, basically went to every state and said, what have you got? And I can tell you that right now there's a bunch of states out there waiting for us to develop.
Yeah, they'll just.
Can you charge for that?
Yeah, I was just going to say. Yeah, right.
For a price, we can.
Right. We'll become a consultant, right? Yeah.
I would like to comment on Mr. Brown's compliment for it's not my team. This is a team that really is a cross-divisional team at this agency, and I'm proud of the fact that we're all part of that. I mean, this was something that you couldn't have done in state parks alone, nor could you have done it with administrative resources alone or information technology. Hundreds of people have been involved in this. Yeah. Each one of those recommendations had a specific team assigned to it. Senior staff meets many times a week to work out issues and resolve this. We put together an internal SAO audit team. Brent Leisure needs to be commended for his work on that. He's a State Parks Regional Director. He's been the major interface between the State Parks Division and the Administrative and IT Divisions. Larry Seeks, a project management technologist that's made the paperwork flow on this thing pretty effectively, very effectively. Jeannie Munoz, who we pulled from another division to get kind of a new set of eyes on this, came out of the Wildlife Division and has helped extremely much in terms of, you know, giving us some new ideas. Sometimes you've been in the business so long you don't catch things. So I really think it's a broad team effort, and I would congratulate all that team.
How is this question of a high-quality park system, which is, and you say your vendors have worked with other states. I mean, and they're obviously very quantifiable things through that, but is there a paragon out there? I mean, is there one somewhere in the country that everybody says this is what we're striving for?
Well, I'll probably bounce that one to Walt. I will tell you that we have heard things, for example, like Arkansas, the state of Arkansas, which came up with a way to fund parks through a sales tax, has actually made some very dramatic improvements, and there's a lot of talk going on around the country about the way their state parks have really gone from substandard to being top of the line. Those are the kinds of things I think that you hear out there. There are some examples of states where funding has been answered, where the parks are looking in a lot better shape than they did before. This group, Pros Consulting, and there's an associated architectural firm that works with them, Fisher Heck out of San Antonio, are out there looking at other states and trying to identify a comparable high-quality systems out there.
Any other questions? Thank you for your presentation. Next item is committee item number three, financial overview. Mary Fields will make the presentation.
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, I'm Mary Fields, Chief Financial Officer, and I'm here to provide the financial overview. The focus of our presentation today will to provide a year-end revenue and budget status for fiscal year 2007. We'll close that one out and provide a revenue and budget status for the first quarter of fiscal year 2008. So let's start off with 2007. When comparing the state park gross receipts through August of 2007, at $35.62 million, we're up 4.9%, or $1.67 million over last year's collection. There were two primary drivers for the annual increase, and those were basically an increase in the facility fees and also an increase in activities and concessions.
So we raised fees.
The facilities fees, really, there were a few parks that were primary drivers on facilities. Indian Lodge brought in a good portion of that increase. There were multiple parks, but that one was one of them. And it actually was a good driver for the activities and concessions as well. And the Texas State Railroad was another key one there. But there were several parks. Those were some of the primary ones.
Texas State Railroad, you all let go of that.
It actually did.
It was a big contributor.
Yeah. We gave it away.
For revenues when compared to the prior year, yes. Believe it or not, yes.
I couldn't resist.
I couldn't either.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Our moving on to our boat revenue as of August 31st, we were at $21.6 million. This is up by 6.1% or $1.24 million compared to the same period last year. Here, all the categories of revenue were up, with registrations and sales tax really being the primary contributors. We continue to transfer 15% of the registration and titling fees to Fund 64, and that totaled $2.8 million for the year. Our license sales revenues were also up as at the end of the year. Most of these things are no surprise. We had these conversations pretty much all through last fiscal year. But at $88.1 million, we were at $2.2 million in revenues as compared to last year, or 2.6%. And again, all categories of revenue were higher than the previous year. In looking at the number of licenses sold, correlates somewhat with the revenues. At $2.73 million, we were up 1.7% as of the end of August when compared to the prior year. And you can see the categories kind of summed up on the slide. When comparing our 2007 revenue collections to the annual revenue estimates, we exceeded our estimated revenue in all of the categories. We collected just over 100% of our Fund 9 Game Fish and Water Safety Funds, 121.6% in our state park funds. And let me talk about this one just a little bit. That increase was mostly attributed to the land sale proceeds from Eagle Mountain Lake, that $9.2 to $9.3 million. And also there were gas royalties from that property. That contributed to that increase. The local park fund at 129.3% there, the increases there were really attributed to interest earnings primarily. And then the other category was at 144.9%. And this category actually is comprised of multiple funds. There were a couple of funds that really exceeded their estimates, so they were drivers for that percentage. In looking at the budget, our overall budget decreased by $49.6 million since I reported last June, or as of the end of June. Our adjusted budget is at $297.1 million. Budget adjustments were made. These are summarized for July and August, and then year-end closing adjustments are summarized here. I'm not going to review all of these. I'll just hit a couple of the highlights. The unexpended balances of $40.8 million, most of that will be carried forward, and about $34 million of it is related to construction. The rest of it is federal funds and donations. The miscellaneous adjustments of that $15.6 million, there's about $13 million of that of additional federal funds that are under review, and we'll be moving those, the majority of those, forward into 2008 as well. So when we compare to that adjusted budget and look at kind of how we did as far as expending the funds, we ended up with only 1.3% of the budget remaining. So we closed out the year fairly well. About as close as you can get without going over.
Congratulations. Yeah.
Moving ahead here with 2008, I do want to just mention here, I have revised this state park receipt slide just a little bit to get us comparable. I'm showing only continued operations. So we're not looking at the revenue from the 18 historic sites that were transferred to the Historical Commission and the Texas State Railroad, which we just talked about. So those revenues are out here so that we can kind of look at apples to apples. So when you look here, we're at $8.27 million as of the end of November, and that's up 6.3% or about $489,000 over last year. And again, really all the categories exceed the prior year. Activities and concessions is just slightly below. But
this would be 3 months, September, October, November?
Yes, that's activity through then.
I mean, it's just 3 months, first quarter.
Yeah. First quarter.
Yeah, fiscal year. Okay.
And I will mention, if you did add in the remaining revenue there, it only takes for 2008 on the state park receipts, it only increased it by about $80,000. So that's what's been collected at those historic sites during this period of time that will be transferred to the Historical Commission.
So that transferred as of January 1?
It'll be transferred as of February 1.
February 1.
Yes, sir. Yes. The boat revenue here as of November 30th is at $3.4 million. Again, this is up by 4.4% or $142,000 compared to last year at the same time. The registration revenue is just down slightly. The revenue for titles issued and the sales tax revenues are up. Again, on that transfer, that 15% transfer, we're at about $429,000 based on the revenues through November. More good news here with the license sales revenue. That's also up as of the end of November at $60.7 million. We're up $1.7 million in revenues or 2.9%. All categories of revenue are higher than the previous year. The only category that's not is resident hunting. That's down by about 2.6%. It appears to be offset by combo sales, which are up about 2.5%. So I would guess there's just a change in the license purchaser's preference. In reviewing the number of licenses sold at 1.88 million, we're up 5.8% as of the end of November. I'm not going to read the categories there. You can kind of see how they're looking on the side. I will comment on the fishing. That's looking real good, and a lot of that's related to the freshwater at this point. When comparing our 2008 revenue collections and comparing those to the annual revenue estimates, we are doing well, which is no surprise, you know, after we just discussed growth and all the major revenue sources. With 25% of the year elapsed, we collected 45.2% of game, fish, and water, 23.4% of state park funds, 36% of the local park fund, and the other categories at 93.1%. And here again, there's multiple funds. The artificial reef fund is doing real well, and also the capital account. And looking at our budget, our overall budget, since we talked about that this summer, has increased by $18.8 million, taking our budget to $424.6 million. Budget adjustments made during the months of September, October, and November are summarized on the slide. Here you can see some of the unexpended balances from 2007 coming in. You'll see more of those as the year progresses. You can also see grants of $5.2 million are being added. And again, I spoke to y'all about that this summer. As they're approved, we will add them into the budget. There was one large grant there for endangered species, but there's multiple that are being pulled in. And we received a couple of significant donations, one for artificial reef and another one to go toward the construction of the Game Warden Academy. In reviewing our budget versus expense, we have 79.8% of the budget remaining with 25% of the fiscal year elapsed. The operational categories, salaries and operating and equipment, are really basically on track. You'll see the grants and capital catch up as the year progresses. And that concludes my presentation. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Mary, a quick question on, I can't remember, on total licenses sold, does that reflect from fiscal year 08 from 07, does that reflect a recategorization of some of the license types, or did we do anything with that last year?
We did not make any big changes to our license types between 07 and 08, the license years. It was 06 to 07 were the changes.
Okay. I think it's pretty comparable.
Yes.
I'd point out, just to make a comment, too, Mary touched on grants, and I know Commissioner Martin every time we get an opportunity, let me just put it this way, every time we get an opportunity in working with whether it's the feds or any organization out there that provides grants, our people, our staff, field staff and division directors take advantage of those opportunities to participate in the grant programs that are out there. This recent tour of the Homeland Security issues along the border, you know, I don't think we let those feds get away with that. It cost them about $1 million. So Will and Pete and his folks have done a really good job through the years of working, and you'll see some additional numbers, some additional reports on that. But that's an area that that we're working really hard these days, and it's out there. And it's just a matter of knowing them knowing us, and what we're doing, how we would spend their money, how we utilize their money to accomplish what's important to them and what fits in our operations. So we're working that pretty hard.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Mayor.
I would also like to point out, Mr. Chairman, at each of your places, kind of going along with Mary's report of FY07, our little annual report is prepared each year, prepared by our communications division, Lydia and her shop. You know, and it's a 26-page snapshot of, you know, what happened in Parks and Wildlife in FY07. And I can't pick this one up without looking at the picture down here on the center bottom. The fellow in the boat that appears to be fishing, he's actually perusing Mother Neff State Park. Because it was about 15 feet underwater.
Amazing.
And also, none of us will remember FY07 without remembering in the upper right corner the loss of two of our game wardens, Ty Patterson and Justin Hurst. So in this little report, there's some really pretty pictures of really handsome people and all that stuff, you know, followed by pictures of us. But,
yeah.
But it's a good snapshot of the agency and some of the issues that we were dealing with, legislative process, funding process, and where we are. So I hope you'll take a chance and get an opportunity to look at that. We appreciate you and her shop putting this together. All the DDs participate in the process. Take a look at that when you get a chance.
Thank you, Bob. Committee item number four is electronic license sales. Gene McCarthy, making the presentation.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, for the record, my name is Gene McCarthy. I'm Deputy Executive Director for Administration. The item before you is a briefing item on the department's hunting and fishing license sales system. Just to let you know right up front, I'm kind of the front guy here. There's a lot of other people that know a whole lot more about this than I do. One of them is the gentleman with me, Tom Newton. He's our license sales system manager. And I also have George Rios, our information technology division director, available to answer any questions about technology, because that's going way over my head.
Let me point out, Tom is the, I don't know, three or four times a year, I will forward you the little graphs and charts of our sales statuses. I usually refer you to the one chart because that's the only one, the graph, because that's the only one I can really understand. Tom is the gentleman that assembles all that information for us and done a great job of that, and I appreciate his help on that. Very, very useful for those of us tracking that information.
The department's license sales system dates back to 1900, and at that time utilized paper licenses and permits issued by hands. This system was in place up until 1997. In 1997, the manual paper license system utilized approximately 3,200 sales outlets, which included sales agents such as sporting goods stores, convenience stores, and Parks and Wildlife Department offices. As you might expect, there were numerous problems with this system, such as cash flow, accountability, and timely data reporting. There was really no way to audit the system. The system worked with 3,200 different agents out there, every one of them with a book, carbon copy. They were bonded agents, but the timeliness of them reporting the data and submitting the money to us was a significant problem for us right up until 97. In 97, the department initiated its first automated point-of-sale system. This system was developed and managed by Transactive and was a major improvement over the old manual system. But it still had a number of shortcomings. The speed on the system was very slow. The system was not very stable. We had a number of outages from time to time. And again, we had reporting problems. Cash flow was better, and cash remittance was better. In 1997, we were utilizing about 3,000 different sales agents, again, including sporting goods stores, convenience stores, parks and wildlife offices. In 2002, we converted to a much more sophisticated point-of-sale system. Sometimes you'll hear this system referred to as the Hypercom system. It was developed and managed by WorldCom, WorldCom MCI, and then ultimately MCI as they went through different iterations of that corporation. This system had numerous operational improvements, such as real-time reporting, improved accounting functions, agent administration, and customer database administration. In 2002, we were utilizing approximately 2,400 different sales sites. In 2004, we brought up the internet component of our system. This system utilized the internet website as a sales agent, and the department fulfills the sale of the license by mailing out the license to the buyer within 24 hours. Today, the internet site accounts for approximately 2% of all of our sales, and I say that in that that's kind of a double-edged sword. There's a huge opportunity for growth in the internet area, but when you think about the internet as a single sales agent, it is our single largest sales agent in the state. The next largest is a Super Walmart in Fort Worth, Dallas area in terms of an individual sales site. In 2007, the old point-of-sale system was replaced by a web-based thin client system that utilizes a central server and data center that communicates over the internet with multiple client computers, thin clients, as we call them. This system is much a very big improvement over the old Hypercom system. It's much more robust in terms of available memory. than the old point of sale system, and enables the agency to push out a lot more information and to utilize the license sales system in a lot of different ways. It provides a lot of flexibility for application and function. And the other thing is this system is significantly faster than the old system. The old Hypercom system was averaging about 6 minutes per transaction. This system, if they are hooked up to high-speed internet, is about 3 minutes. And the real limitation is the person who's operating it. It's not the system. We are currently under contract with Verizon to operate this and manage this system until 2013. Licenses are sold through this system with state parks, law enforcement offices, wildlife management areas, and retail outlets, and the internet, and from a 1-800 phone system. In 2007, we sold approximately 2.8 million recreational hunting and fishing licenses, or 2.1 million recreational hunting and fishing licenses, and a total of 2.8 million total license sales that generated about $88.1 million in net revenue for the department. We believe that the current system really provides a very convenient service for our customers. Licenses are sold at over 1,600 physical locations. We provide sale at Walmart. Our two largest sales agents are Walmart and Academy. Walmart has about 334 stores, which accounts for about 43% of total sales. Academy has 69 locations for about 20%. You can see Academy on a store-by-store basis, it really outsells Walmart. All Academies are on high-speed DSL, and that this last year became a real selling point for them. I mean, they really marketed the idea, if you don't want to stand in line to get your license, come to Academy because we're fast. Walmart picked up on that, and they quickly converted their top 50 stores to DSL. The rest of their stores are mostly on dial-up, a little slower, and they do have some backup at the sales counter. In addition to all of those locations, we still have the 1-800 system that is just call in. We'll issue a license. We'll issue you a confirmation number. You can hunt anything or fish anything that doesn't need a tag right then immediately using that confirmation number. We will try to get your tags and your license mailed out within 24 hours. And then the same thing with the internet sales system.
We operate those, or do Verizon operate?
We operate the 1-800. The internet sales goes through a portal. You get to it through our website, but it connects directly to Verizon.
Is business hours on 1-800? Refresh my memory on that. What are the
They're really standard working hours. They're 9 to 6 Monday through Friday. We would like to expand that, but
for weekends at least.
Yeah, through the weekends, but we have some problems with FTE caps and other sort of things that are imposed by the legislature to be able to put people to operate it.
The internet's 24/7.
The internet is 24/7. So we do have an opportunity 24/7 to get it through the internet, or many of the super Walmarts are open 24 hours a day.
Gene, is there a cost to us with these different entities? And if there is, how much of a cost is it?
Well, we paid about $3 million in commission to this last year to Verizon for operating the system. Basically, it's a transaction fee, and in that we also pay 5% to each one of the vendors, 5% of the value of the sale to each one of our license agents. That ended up being about $3.7 million last year. So to operate the system, like I said, it's an $88 million system. We're paying about $6 million in operational costs to agents and to transaction fees to the...
That's a good question, Commissioner. We looked at... I can see some of the pain on some of the faces of staff here as I mention this, but we looked at building this system ourselves and operating it ourselves, owning the system. And quite frankly, you know, we could have done it. We would have had to allocate a significant additional resources, spending ahead of what we had available, additional staff. And we came to the conclusion after a lengthy study and amount of work inside and outside the agency that we were better off going with a vendor like Verizon. And a similar issue, reason I take a moment on this, we're dealing with a similar set of issues in this state park accounting and reservation system. We could build a system ourselves. We could own the system. But there's a huge cost up front. The state park system will, in fact, basically probably do the same thing. There'll be a piece cost associated with it in some form or fashion, and that gives you in addition to the expertise that those people bring who are in that business and do that all the time, it gives you the ability to go back to this system here. We make tweaks and revisions in this system almost every year. And that's an important thing to be able to do, to be able to go in and say, well, no, we don't want it to do that anymore. We want it to do something different. And again, dealing with state government, sometimes it's just more effective to work it through a contractor like Verizon, even though the cost, like we say, in dealing with these vendors, the cost is $6 to $7 million a year. Out of an $88 million system.
And my second question is once you go into buy a license, I didn't know that they were automatic. This is new to me, but once you're in there, can you go to other websites where we have other things that Parks and Wildlife may sell, like licenses and things like that? Is there a way to connect to other areas where we can increase our revenue?
Well, let that go to George.
It's just that one specific thing.
All right. I know this is very difficult to see, but I really wanted you to kind of take a look at, probably see it on the back screen better than either one of these side screens. It kind of gives you a perspective of how available license sales are. Or at least the license sales system is. Each one of those dots represents a different license sales agent, whether it be a corporate chain, a retail agent, or a Parks and Wildlife office. You see the state's pretty well covered, and certainly we're well covered within the major metropolitan areas. Kind of give you a perspective of how the sales are spread out. Said 88% of our sales come from our retail sales agents. Our law enforcement offices are about 5%, 4.75%. Texas Parks and Wildlife headquarters, and that's a number of different sales venues within the agency. It's our front counter, which used to be right outside the door here. We've now moved it over to D building. And then a couple of other clerks is about 3%, and then, as I said, the internet is 2%. The call center is about 1%. Parks are about 0.5%, and wildlife management area is about 0.1%. We've had lots of discussion over the past in the license system as to what other states are doing. I wanted to give you kind of an idea of what some of the states that are somewhat comparable to Texas are doing in terms of the way they're selling licenses. So we picked California, Florida, Michigan, New York, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. If you'll see the system providers, there's basically three system providers out there. ALS, which is still on a Hypercom, the old Hypercom system that we were on. In-house, there's a couple of states that have developed in-house, principally Michigan and North Carolina, and then Texas and New York is currently working with Verizon, and we're both on a thin client application, web-based application, which is probably the higher end of the applications. North Carolina is on thin client application, but they're maintaining that system themselves. If you also notice that they're only looking at about 1.2 million total license sales, as opposed to Parks, Texas Parks Wildlife being up there around 2.8. Interestingly enough, out in California, which we would think would be the technology capital, they don't even use an internet application. Parks and Wildlife does have an internet. We have the call center, and we do have, but we do utilize paper tax.
Before you leave this,
yes, sir.
The obvious one jumps out: Pennsylvania, $4.5 million relative to item volume. Are they selling other things? Do they not do a combo? I mean, what?
I think they count everything they have as an individual unit, and they don't do combos and so forth.
If we looked at Michigan's system, obviously developed in house, I'm just curious as a benchmark opportunity to see how it functions. And
we didn't look at Michigan's system. We did send staff to North Carolina and study North Carolina systems extensively, and we utilized, to some extent, we utilized the information there when we were developing our in-house application proposal. And of course, in either case, you know, the in-house application was going to cost several million dollars in terms of just getting up to speed in terms of the software application and then the acquisition of the hardware for each one of the sales. In the case where we went with Verizon, one of the reasons we did a fairly long contract time is just from the standpoint of they bought all the thin clients, they paid for all the hardware up front, and they've got the major capital investment, not the agency. Yes, sir.
What did North Carolina use in lieu of paper tax?
They've got a scorecard system that they I think you can download it, or you receive it in the mail with your license, or you get it at the time that you get your license, and it's as I understand it, I haven't actually seen it, but it's a punch card, and then they have like 24 hours to call in the kill. They have to punch what it is and record what it is, and then call it in over a 1-800 number.
Yes, sir.
Which states have gone paperless, and what's the what are the law enforcement issues that have surfaced as they live with paperless systems?
To our knowledge, none of them have gone paperless.
Probably Missouri might be the closest to paperless, but they still have different pieces of paper you have to have for different things. This thing that Tom mentioned of you make a kill and you say of an animal that has to be registered like a deer, let's say. Then you have a number right there in a certain time frame that you have to call in. And once that's called in, then that harvest is assigned a code number, whatever that a warden, when a warden checks you, you've got that code number, you're all okay. There's some angst, I'll just tell you. All of us have sat in the various Southeastern and Midwest Association meetings with their biological staff or with their law enforcement staff. None of them are perfectly happy. You know, there's always some give and take. If you give up a tagging system, there's got to be some mechanism. So we continue to look, and certainly would welcome any suggestions, and they're not hesitant to try systems that make it simpler.
I just wonder whether we ought to try pilot. Experiment with it and see if there's some experimentation with some of these systems and some of the approaches. We have to see whether there, I assume, there's a pretty substantial savings on big business factors. I understand.
You can get away from the paper.
Bob,
how to me is a cheap a pilot would be a cheap way to look into that study, or maybe we're meant to it, but just look at experimenting.
How do the states handle it that have a daily bag limit of deer?
Well, Louisiana just sort of keeps hunting. You know?
That's good. That sounds like East Texas, doesn't it?
John and Mr. Parker, the one that I can think of, and I, quite frankly, I've Clayton and Wolf or somebody maybe in the audience can answer it better, but I know that South Carolina, some of the far southeastern states used to have daily bag limits, you know, one a day, right, that type of thing. And I think what they had, and maybe the ones that still have a multiple bag of some kind, they have a written record, a sheet, a place on the back of your license to log in the harvest. I believe that's probably the most common way that's done. You know, it's, again, most of them have gone away from that. But there's still a couple out there. I think South Carolina still has.
Maybe some. Mississippi.
Maybe.
Gene, I'd like to visit the internet situation again. Do we go out and how do we advise the public that you can purchase a license over the internet? Are we doing any?
We are doing some marketing, but that is certainly the one of the key things that we're looking at in the future is increasing our marketing effort on the internet, trying to drive as many people to the internet as we possibly can. The other component of the internet that we've got to look at is there is a convenience fee, and so we're trying to minimize that convenience fee. We're looking at trying to minimize that convenience fee as much as we can. It's a $5 convenience fee to try to entice more use of the internet, but we will be looking at a much more aggressive marketing plan in the future.
And are we doing anything to specifically target the youth of our communities to purchase licenses on the internet, since that would be the bigger user or that is the bigger user of the internet? Are we doing anything along
those lines? Not that I know of, no sir.
You know, we've looked at the internet thing is one that it's kind of hard to read, and George or Gene may be able to help me here, but I believe the states that have been in internet sales the longest and have campaigned it the most, I think, please somebody help me out here, but I think about 11 to 12% of their sales through the internet is about as high as they're getting, maybe 15. George, do you recall? Yeah, somewhere in that range of ones that have really campaigned it, that have really tried to push it that way.
Has it been an overall increase, or are they just taken away from purchasing?
No, I think it's just a replacement purchase. Yeah, not an increase.
So you're taking away then from your vendors?
Yes.
Walmart's,
yes.
Academy, they look at its competition. That's
right.
Yeah,
that's right.
As a clarification, when you go to Texas License Connection, you can get into the TPW website from that, or you
can get into that from the TPW website.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Right.
But not the independent point of sale internet system.
That's correct.
Right.
Correct. And to your point about competition, if you'll notice, we've gone from, we basically cut the number of agents we have had over time from 1997 to now almost in half. And a lot of that has to do with changes in the way we approach it. When they were on paper, it didn't cost them anything. It now costs them a DSL line, some equipment rental costs, and things like that. So we've really those people who are selling licenses now want to sell licenses,
yeah,
because they've got to pay because there's something out of their pocket going into it.
Right. Well, and it helps attract people to the store.
We also, Gene, had some discussion, I think about a year ago, about attrition and how, you know, when we lose people, how do we get them back into the system and facilitate it for them so they can purchase their license or be reminded. And that's a little bit about what you're talking about in terms of expanding the internet channel or some mailer or something.
Have right.
We developed that, yeah, and going to other segments like youth.
Lydia, Communication Division, Inland Division are working with a grant from Recreational Boating. Yeah, Boating Fishing Foundation to do some questionnaires and do some some marketing survey work out there to see if we can address that churn issue in freshwater and saltwater fishing.
Right.
But that is a very valid point.
Something we're looking at pretty actively. Yep.
Lastly, I think we've touched on all these issues, but the discussion we've had at the table, you recognize that the current tagging requirements is probably the biggest limiting factor in terms of moving forward with other technologies. As long as we have a need to produce a secure, non-reproducible tag that must be affixed to an animal, and that is used as a bag limit control mechanism, then we're pretty well set with where we are, and that's one of the key issues that we're looking at. That's one of the key issues that wildlife is looking at. One of the key issues that law enforcement is looking at in terms of moving forward in use of technology. As I said, we're looking at increasing our focus on marketing to migrate people to customers to the internet, just from a convenience perspective. But we've got to address a couple issues there, with the convenience fee being one of them. And we're investigating the use of interactive voice response, as we talked about. That's the call-in kind of call-in tag system. And then ultimately we'd like to be able to look at migrating off the paper system to a smart card system, which is basically a little computer chip and a card that knows everything about you. And that's pretty far future kind of stuff. So that's kind of a briefing on the past, present, and future of the current license system and what we're looking at.
What kind of options have you looked at with regard to physical licenses?
In terms of physical licenses, what do you mean?
You mentioned that you've been looking at several different items regarding the tags.
I'm not. That's wildlife and law enforcement are doing some work there. I'm not sure where they are in terms of how they want to address those issues.
Thank you, James.
Any questions?
Any other questions? Thank you. Many items, number 5 and 6, have been combined into one item, license fee increases and conservation funding, and got Scott Borup and Larry McKinney are going to present.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, once again, for the record, my name is Scott Borup, Deputy Executive Director of Operations. I'm just up here to introduce this item. I'm pleased to say this is another cross-divisional effort that we put together in the agency. A little bit of background for the new commissioners once again. Fund 9, as opposed to Fund 64, which you heard about this morning in the SAO briefing, Fund 64 funds primarily state parks and some of the support divisions partially. Fund 9 funds primarily the natural resource side of the agency and also some of the support divisions. And just as a bit of background so you understand what I'm talking about, wildlife, both the fisheries divisions and law enforcement are funded exclusively through Fund 9. Some of the support divisions, and I'll use human resources as an example, support both Fund 9 and Fund 64. They do human resources for both the state parks and the natural resource side of the agency. So human resources, communications, administrative resources, and infrastructure get some Fund 9 funding. As you heard in the last commission meeting, we are trying to be proactive in looking at the financial issues that Fund 9 faces, both now and in the future. We do not want to get into the same situation we got into with state parks, where we had serious issues that required cutbacks in program services and staff. And to that end, per your direction in the last meeting, Dr. McKinney has been the leader of this cross-divisional effort to bring you some information today about where we are in Fund 9, what some of the financial issues facing Fund 9 are, and what some of the primary issues are going to be as we move forward into the future.
Doc. Mr. Chairman and members of the Commission, for the record, I'm Dr. Larry McKinney. I'm the Director of Coastal Fisheries. And in this context, I'm eligible for full retirement no matter what you all might decide. Let's get started.
And that's why you got this job?
Yeah,
right.
Exactly right. Let me get started here. And I have to start with just a one-slide summary of as Scott said, our last meeting, and basically talking about what we're facing here in a couple of things. One, there's some serious challenges we're having to going to have to deal with, and one I characterize as ecosystem management being that the types of things we're going to have to deal with in the future to be successful in managing fish and wildlife are much broader than we've ever had before. It's simply not setting bag and size limits and seasons. We can't do that anymore. We have to be able to influence a lot of other things that we don't regulate at all. So we're working in those areas, be it water or habitat or those types of issues, and that obviously is complex in dealing with it. And of course, we have a changing demographic. Our whole state is changing and growing, and we have to be able to respond to that. So those are a couple of things that we talked about last time that's driving us to taking a look at our resources, our revenues, and how we do these types of things. To say nothing about what we're going to speak about today is some of those factors about inflation and salaries and all that are driving us. So what we said is our team is a goal to what we're trying to achieve here. We put this in the terms of a goal, basically saying we wanted to assure funding necessary to maintain conservation successes and expand the efforts to meet increasingly complex conservation challenges while enhancing opportunities for our constituents to access fish and wildlife resources. That's what we're trying to do here. And as we began to go through this, we really came up with, and this is what you would expect, we identified four areas of needs that we would have to address in order to meet that goal. One, of course, is the adequate operational funding. We have to have the ability to give our people the equipment, the tools to do their job in an efficient and safe manner. That's very straightforward. Competitive salaries. Clearly, if we want to have the best people available to us to do this job, we have to be able to compete with other agencies in particular. Sustainable fund balances. This is an area in which we'll spend a little bit of time. It's a little more difficult to talk about here, but basically it's those balances of which support us through good times and bad, and how we work in that direction. And of course, if we want to look at these new demographics and supporting folks, we got to look at new and expanded programs. How do we deal with that? So my briefing this morning will be predicated on looking at each of these four areas and giving you an idea of our analysis, what we've come up with as to what we would need in order to accomplish in each of these areas. First of all, let's talk about adequate operational funding. And these are the budget categories of salaries, basic operations, buying gas and that type of thing, and capital equipment, the cars, the boats, the motors, all those things that we need to accomplish our mission. And I put up here just basically a hypothetical distribution of how we budget these things. It's different for each of our divisions because some divisions have more land or infrastructure they have to support, so it varies. But one of the things we watch very closely in each budget year, and Mr. Cook makes sure of this, that we don't get into what we call this salary creep. It's very easy for us to move more and more money into salaries because there's more demand there and cut back on that operational cost to the point where they can't do the job. And so we watch that very closely to make sure that we can do so. You just had this discussion earlier, for example, about going to the Internet type of thing, and certainly there's a lot of convenience there, but under the conditions we have now, when we drive people to the Internet, that means someone here in this building is going to have to get that Internet sales, print out a license, put postage on it, and mail it out. So there's operational costs to anything that we do that we have to account for in our jobs. So this is clearly an important area that we got to keep up with those. Now, for us, in Fund 9, the operational budget for this year is about $31.4 million. That's what it costs us to operate day-to-day. And when we look back at how those expenses have increased over the years, going back to the last fee increase in 2004, basically our analysis showed that our operational expenses increased by about 26.5% over that period of time, which is a rate of 6.6 per year. And you take a look, and we've done the analysis on those kind of fixed costs to see where they come from, and they're no surprise. When you look at fuel expenses have increased 68%, electricity 32%, and so on. So there's clearly been a number of increases that we've had to deal with in that operational expense. Inflation over that period of time has been 2.7% per year. So basically what that tells us is that every year we lose about $850,000 in purchasing ability. I mean, that disappears in inflation. We lose that and lost it every year. And so over this period of time, since the last fee increase, we've lost about $4.2 million of purchase power that we had to make up by either not doing something or from other areas. So that's clearly an ongoing issue that we all deal with, no matter what business it is, or in our own homes, we have to deal with that inflation issue. And typically, in our agency, we've not done that. We would put a fee increase in, and we eat that cost until it becomes necessary for us to do it again. And so that's an issue, I guess, we talked about last time, last commission meeting, about how can we deal with that particular issue. But clearly, that need is something we have to address every year. Salaries and that category. Let me. We're going to spend a little bit more time on this one. It's so important to us. Anytime you ask any of our division directors, what's our most important asset in your division, and the response is going to be, well, it's the people that we have. That you'd expect that, but in almost any operation, but in at Parks and Wildlife, it is really that in spades, if you will. We have people in our agency that have made this a career, that could have made more money other places, but they're bought into what we're trying to do here. They're into our mission. You see it every Thursday that you come here with the service awards and the retirement awards and what these folks have done and how long they've been with us. So they're a tremendous asset, and we get far more out of them than perhaps we should expect, but they do. Whatever the job is, they do it no matter what. So they're an important resource to us, and clearly we need to replenish that resource, because eventually we all retire and someone has to come in behind us, and we want those people to come in behind us and stay with us and do the job that you all expect. The problem is that right now we are not competitive with other state agencies or other agencies of our type across the country, and that was part of this analysis we're going through. Just a quick a step back for a second. Our employees in Parks and Wildlife and the Fund 9 side operate under three different schedules. You're a part of one of three different fee schedules, Schedule A, B, or C. The Schedule C is law enforcement, game warden, and Schedule C salaries are comparable, are set to all of the law enforcement across the state, primarily DPS. So there is an automatic means there, so we can at least keep our game wardens competitive across state. Now, it doesn't say they can compete with counties or cities or those types of things, but at least we can do that, so that's been helpful. But in the other two categories, the Schedule A, which is administrative support, our technicians, budgeteers, those types of things, and then Schedule B, which is biologists, lawyers, attorneys, hydrologists, all those types of things fit into those two categories. That's not the case. They're not tied to anything, and so they're subject to whatever happens with the legislature. And the legislature has responded and tried to help there to deal with inflation. But if you take a look at where we are, and you can see the legislature has tried to address the issue. And as I said, in Schedule C, we've been very successful in trying to keep our wardens competitive, but it has not been the case in the A's and B's. And that's what we have to deal with. So looking at the analysis, I picked out our technicians. We have, and that's a large group of our Schedule A folks. Our technicians are divided into Techs 1, 2, 3, and 4, and basically that's a Tech 1 is kind of an introductory level, and as you move up in experience and skills, you can move or go into these higher levels. And you can see here that for the Tech 1 and 2s in particular, it's pretty dramatic that within those folks with up to 2 years of experience in 2007, we lost almost 40% to 50% of those. Half those folks stayed with us for a little while, gained some experience, and then moved on because the opportunities were just too great. Once they've been with us for a while, of course, we tend to hang on to them, which is helpful. But another way of looking at it, if you just combine all the technicians together, just not, regardless of whether 1, 2, 3, or 4, just all technicians last year, of the 45 and that had 2 years or less experience, that turnover rate was 40%. A little more experience is 15% and on down. So you can see where the impact is. And when we do, I'll come to that in a second. But another look at, let's just look at agency altogether. When we have our folks come in, they'll pick up a year or so experience, and there's a tendency for them to look elsewhere. And so our turnover rate is somewhere between 25% and 30% there. And of course, it drops down a little bit as we go on and hold on to them for a few years. Overall, our turnover rate, all categories, is about 14%. TTEQ, which is the next closest natural resource agency to us in size, is 12%, and all natural resource agencies is about 12%, so we're a little bit higher on that end. So that gives an indication kind of where we are salary wise, competitive wise, and it makes the point that reemphasizes the point of where we are on our scale. In each of the salary categories within the schedules, no matter what you're a Tech 1 or Tech 2, that salary range is divided into four quarters or quartiles. And basically what happens is you bring a person in that first quartile when they're new, and then over the years, as time they accumulate experience and so forth, you can, through merit increases and others, move them along that scale. That's typically what happens. You move people along through that scale and give them rewards for good performance and those types of things. Our budget situation has been so we haven't been able to do that. And it shows here that when you compare our Fund 9 division, which is the light green, to the blue, the rest of the statewide, you can see that most of our staff is stuck in that fourth quartile. We just have not been able to move them along. And that's where we begin. That's where we lose competitive. When people stay with us for a little while, if they haven't got the opportunity to move forward, they're going to start looking, you know, in other places, and then we're not competitive. So if the goal is we at least want to be competitive with other state agencies of our type, what would it take? And basically that means we need to shift those positions over in those quartiles and move people along that scale so we're at least at the same level with other state agencies. If we're going to do that, it costs us about $7 million a year in increased salaries to do that.
Just for Fund 9.
We did an analysis for agencies that holds about $11 million. If you want to go through. So it's not. This is our biggest expense, and of course this is an important area to us. But it's a serious issue that we have to look at. So if we were to do that, we would become competitive with other state agencies, at least in that level. The next question being is, well, how does that put us, or what does that put us in regard to other agencies across the country of our kind? And basically, we did a little analysis there, and it's difficult to do. You have to make some assumptions, but I pulled out some categories of budgets that at least or positions I'm familiar with. And when I look at that across the state, if we did match these other state agencies, right now we're in the lower third, we're below half, we're in the lower third to quarter of agencies across the country. But if we were to make those adjustments, that, as you can see by the chart here, it would move us up above those averages. In fact, I think in most cases it would move us into to the upper third to a quarter as far as paying salaries for those other agencies, and that would make us very competitive, and that's, you know, obviously where we'd like to be. So it seems to me that we can address those salary issues in this manner if that's what we wanted to do. So that's what it would take. Okay.
Larry, just so I understand, on the salary, in looking at the other state agencies, are we taking the 50% quartile, or is this the upper end of agencies? How did we, I guess, have to be applied?
On this chart, for example,
right.
That chart just basically takes the distribution of salaries across all state agencies, which is available, and just lay them on this graph of where those people fall in all of those areas. And on an average, that's the distribution. If I'm answering your question. Then we took our salaries and where they fell in each of those quartiles and laid them on top of it. Am I getting at what you're saying?
Well, I mean, you know, there's probably a high end and a medium and low end of all these various agencies, and so we have all that information.
Mm-hmm. That's all real.
There's always going to be someone that's hiring.
Oh, and you always expect that. Yeah, right. And of course, as you move from the first to second to third or fourth quartile, it's going to go down. That's what you'd expect. You're people. But unfortunately, our comparison here is that we're not able to move our people along at the rate of other state agencies as they can. Primarily because they can go back in and ask for additional appropriations and revenue. Ours is all based on fees.
Right.
And that's the only way we can do ours, and we don't have them, If they're not appropriate to us, we can't.
Yeah. Larry, on the suggested number on the bottom, is that what the $7 million that the adjustment
is? The $7 million? Yes, sir. If we were going to shift so that green and blue bar looked approximately the same all the way across, that we just reflected that's what it would cost us to do.
And is that $7 million? I'm sorry. That's $7 million. No, it's just $7 million per year, but is it $7 million to get caught up? Not $7 million per year every year after that, is it?
What? Yes, sir. Once you get the $7 million, you have to hold it. You can't cut them back. I mean, it's not 7 plus 7 plus 7, but it is 7.
So to get the green bar up to the blue bar, mm-hmm, would cost us $7
million. The shift.
All right. But $7 million is also a what is almost 15% or more of the total budget for Fund 9, right? Now you said Fund 9 was $31
million? No, that's operational. That's just operational.
Oh, that's just operational.
That's just operational.
Okay, what is the total amount of Fund 9?
Mary, it's 100. Look it up, I'll get it exactly for you here.
Okay. And so it would cost $7 million to get caught up, but it would also cost $7 million to maintain?
Every year. Because once you raise those salaries, you need to hold them there, so it's going to cost that. But that doesn't account for anything.
Not a one-shot deal.
Yeah.
$7 million a year, not including inflation in future years.
Right.
In looking just to keep this possible, we've got the 31.4 in operating, about $71 million in salaries.
Okay.
And the total budget with capital and all that kind of stuff is at 124.5.
Okay.
Two important points there, though, Commissioner, I believe. First is it's a $7 million a year effort to get salaries comparable with other agencies, and it assumes no inflation or any other adjustment, so it's a flat assumption.
Okay.
I was going to ask, how do the other agencies pay, but it's through appropriations?
Well, right. Ours is driven by license amount, what's appropriated to us, and so they can go back and do those, ask for additional appropriated monies from general revenue in order to do that.
Well, we're told a lot of times is through the last few sessions is, well, you don't raise it yourself. So of course that's why we're here today talking about pay increases.
If we want to do merit raise that, and that's exactly, I appreciate that's really the bottom line. The company said, well, raise your license fees and we'll give it to you.
Then we raise license fees, and then they raise out. Okay. Start
after, so, you know. That was Chairman Holt who said that. It wasn't him. Right.
That's why Chairman only stick around about 2 years. They're out of here. One license fee.
And executive director.
Well, they passed the buck to the chairman.
Let me mention one other thing here that's a factor. That every time we sit down and do budgets, you know, when the division directors from year to year and as we go into our legislative appropriation request, which you folks will have to do this summer, you know, one of the issues here, okay, you got 70 some odd million dollars in salaries in this group of divisions, this Fund 9 division. So you could do some salary adjustments with that $70 million. By reducing your number of FTEs, by reducing your number of employees, or by taking money from operations and putting it there. And so we try to balance. Those are issues that when you sit down with the directors this summer and start talking about, okay, what are we going to look for 09, 010, 10, and, you know, future years, those are the kind of issues that you're going to be dealing with. Same thing in parks. If you have money available through fees or through appropriations, there's always that balancing act of, do I want to put a higher percentage? Doc mentioned that earlier. Do I want to put a higher percentage into salaries and take away from operating? Do I not want to do improvements to our fish hatcheries and plow that money into salaries? So it's a real balancing act that we try to stay reasonable with. And again, this presentation is, we're trying to stay ahead of that curve, involve you, let you participate in this process of whatever direction we go. So it's a real, you're thinking here about 3 to 5 years ahead, you know, at any point in time.
When was the last increase?
In 04, about 17%. The third area, and really plays into this too, as Commissioner Martin was talking about, is sustainable fund balances, and this is really the thing that has grabbed our attention of looking at it. And you were talking about how do we meet increases in salaries without raising fees? And we've had a number of salary increases that the legislature has we appreciate granting. But without the fee increases, we've had to go into these balances to meet those salary needs. So what that means, those balances have been declining. And clearly one of the things that we need to do, and it just makes good business practice, is you need to have, particularly if you're working on biennial budgets, you need to have a particular balance to work against to account for hurricanes or droughts or unexpected increases or in costs and those types of things. And looking at that, it made some sense that we would set as a target about 10%. Our overall Fund 9 budget is about $110 million. So a 10% balance, keeping that, would seem to make sense and help us address these issues, and certainly would help keep us from going negative, because that's the issue that we all are going to have to deal with by 2010 and 2011. If we don't address these issues, then we'll have some very difficult budget decisions. Maybe we will be making significant cuts. This is the issue that parks faced some years ago. What we're fortunate now is that we're talking about, we have some opportunities, Mr. Cook said, to address this now. When we have some options, there will not be those options 3 to 5 years from now when we have to make those decisions. So looking at that, what would it take? And it looks like something in the range of $5 to $8 million in additional revenues a year would maintain those fund balances at about that $10 million level and allow us to use them in that way.
There's one other important dynamic for the new commissioners relative to these fund balances, and that is under our sports fish and wildlife restoration programs, those programs are reimbursement programs where we have to step out and spend those dollars first and then apply for reimbursement through the feds. And so you need some kind of balances to ensure the cash flow issue there doesn't catch you in a shortage.
Good point. All
right. Larry,
yes,
do any of the other state agencies maintain the fund balances for emergencies like this?
They certainly do. There's not TCEQ, for example, has a similar issue because they're fee-based too. So really, the issues are fee-based issues. When you're appropriated, when you deal with general revenues, you have a different way of going. You just basically go back to the legislature and say, we either can do these or not. But if you're fee-based like we are, and we have to raise our own revenues, then there's a dynamic there that puts a little extra burden on us over that type of thing. When you have to raise your own money, and the fees, people can buy them or not, depending on economic situations or floods or droughts. So it's a little bit different beyond me to tell you, and I'm sure Mary or someone else could give you a little more detail, but we are different than other agencies because of that.
And have we ever tried to go to the legislature and say, look, in case we need to mobilize game wardens like for the hurricane this past year, to go to them for emergency funding? Have we ever tried to do that and say, look, we want the capability to be able to tap into other resources if there is an emergency? Have we ever gone before the legislature?
Retrospectively, not proactively. And, you know, there is, I think, a state fund for emergencies that we would have some opportunity to try to access. I think these are more for just normal business function issues as much as emergencies, and that is there are a lot of reimbursement issues in Fund 9. I really think that's as important as anything. There's big pieces of money that we're out there expending that has to be reimbursed to us later, that we have to spend those funds up front. So those are not emergencies. Those are normal business practices that require a cash flow balance, or a balance to ensure the cash flow doesn't go negative somewhere in the process.
And you know, it's tough to budget for an emergency. I mean, you can have a contingency, but you can't budget for an emergency. And especially in our business, we know ahead of time how many biologists it's going to take to operate a certain wildlife management area. We know how many biologists it's going to take to operate our coastal operations. We know ahead of time. We know ahead of time how many game wardens it's going to take. But especially on the biological side and our other service side, we know ahead of time how many it's going to take. And you know, if we don't if the money doesn't come in, then it's going to be tough to meet that budget.
I think your question, I've never seen the legislature appropriate what we would call our contingency funding for us. I've not seen that. But if we have resources like our Prop 8 funding that's available for repairs, you know, you have some flexibility from the legislature to use those funds for repairs to structures and facilities. But you don't necessarily have a source to go back to if you have to pull 100 of your staff off and send into an emergency situation. There is where we go to FEMA or, you know, some of the federal organizations like that for reimbursement on equipment and on staffing. And we've done well there. And we're still we're still struggling with it some, but those resources are there.
The other complicating factor of this in trying to look at these balances, and you look at your chart here, which is split into to the green, the blue, and the red, is our restricted, various restricted funds. The blue, for example, stamp funds and things like that. Those are not available for action that you're talking about like that. They're, a big part of those, for example, is in Mr. Drosher's fish hatchery, about $15 million. These are stamp funds that can only be used for very specific purposes, not for normal day-to-day operations. And the green fund is similar to that. It's, for an example, would be if we sold land, that land would have, that money would have to be used to purchase other land. So those are restricted. The only thing we have available to do that is that red bit there. Unfortunately, that sometimes gets lost in the legislature. They work on a much bigger scale than we do, and they just see these big balances out there. They say, well, what are your problems? Because you can see you have a, you look there in 2007, you got a $50 million balance there. Well, in reality, it's about 12 that we could use for any of these types of things. So that makes it a little more difficult as well. They're trying to look at. Final category is looking at new and expanded programs, and clearly there's lots of things we all would like to do and our constituents would like us to do, and we went through a kind of analysis process, but the one thing that came across with all of our divisions is the issue of access. Access is just such a high priority need. When you have a situation where you have over 84,000 applicants for 5,000 hunting positions on public land, boat ramps are backed up where you can't even park on them, and I would say in my division in coastal fisheries for years, I didn't necessarily, that wasn't an issue for us because you got the coastline and the beaches and all that type of thing. But I'm sure all of you have been on the coast recently, and that coastline is filling up with houses and condos. And the fishing piers are the old private boat ramps. That boat ramp may be worth $2 or $3 million as a condo versus a boat ramp. They're all disappearing. So access is just, it will be our big issue. Water, we talk about from an ecosystem level, water, and that is there. But from this side of it, access is a huge issue that we've got to address, and it costs a lot of money. A boat ramp to expand or to renovate, we're talking $500,000 to $1.5 million type of thing. So these are big ticket items, and there are no more land in Texas. It's what we've got. And so this is something that we really need to look at. River access, we talked about paddling trails, a huge demand has just exploded on those types of things. So people, clearly they want a lot of things. We can't get them to our fish and wildlife resources unless we can get them access. So this is the area that we really want to expand on here to provide that opportunity to get at those resources. And in order to do that, we have to look at, as we talked about with all these things, how do we fund those types of things? And that's we've had this discussion before, but it's worth emphasizing again that one of the areas is we really need to take a look at developing new sources of funding to allow those folks that are benefiting from the monies that our hunters and fishers and anglers have expended now to provide access and opportunities. We need to let a lot of other people help us provide that as well. And if we want to do something new, we have a whole group of new folks, new people that we haven't talked to. How do we tap into that area? And we spend a lot of time and are continuing to do so to look at other states. You talked about that this morning. There are models and things that are being tried around the country that we want to tap into and look at and see if we can use them as well. But a lot of that will take legislative support and changes. And so we have to work with our legislative leaders and our constituents to do so. So basically, the objective would be to address these needs before they become critical and we fail in meeting the goal that we started with. And as we talked about earlier, we have some times now where our options are open to us, but we don't want to wait too long. And in doing so, there's really two questions to ask. What's the best strategy to proceed from this point, and what's the time frame within which we must act? And I want to try to answer that second question first, because that's the one that's most straightforward, is that time frame. And that's something we've been thinking a lot about. If we're sitting here at this commission meeting here in January, we could propose a fee increase, for example, right now, and it could be enacted over the spring or whatever in that order. But in reality, until we go through the legislative session and the legislature would agree to that and appropriate it to us, that's not going to occur until May of 2009. And it couldn't even be enacted probably until September of 2009. That's about 18 months. And then revenue being realized, we're talking 2 years. So the reality is that we have a window of time here from now until the end of the session to make a decision of what's the best strategy for addressing these needs. And from the staff perspective and looking at it, I mean, clearly we need to have our constituent support. We need to have that legislative support. We have a lot of work to do. We've got to make our case as well as possible and look at all those options. So although we, you know, there's a tendency to say, let's move up front and try to raise that money as quickly as we can, the reality is we have some time and we need to do it right. We can't afford to miss it. So that's where we are from the staff perspective, would like to have that discussion input from you all and guidance and how can we, what's the best way to approach, what's the strategy that works best to meet all these needs so we can continue to do those things that we've been so successful in doing and meet all those new challenges we've been talking about. So that's, at this point, that's kind of where we are in the presentation. Certainly would entertain questions or comments.
Are you going to begin to scope the needs and funding alternatives with our constituents? Are we going to start that process? And I'm assuming once we get the input from our constituents, to Commissioner Holt's point, we need to go to the legislature and begin to start explaining this process and what our strategies are and what's involved there.
And that's what we're here for, to talk with you all and seek some guidance.
Session actually starts.
Well, there's that issue, and going back to one of his slides, is where he's got 4.1 million wildlife watchers. I mean, if you think about it, we sell about 2.8 million licenses of various types, hunting, fishing, combos, etc. Growth is not very strong, hasn't been over the last few years. We're going to have to expand, where we collect our fees from. Because these are people participating in essentially the same types of activities, outdoors, conservation-oriented, but you could argue not paying for it. Okay? And so I'm expanding or expounding a little bit. I think that's going to be one of the key things we do also is go to these various constituencies, kayakers, canoers, bird watchers, whatever it may be, and their associations, Audubon, whatever it may be. That's already started, Scott. Please jump in there, anybody else, as we start talking to them and asking them to start thinking about participating. As you can imagine, some are willing to talk and others are not willing to talk at all. But that's, we're going to have to get there. Now, whether we get there this round, totally inclusive, I can't imagine we will. But we've got to get it started. You can't keep asking the fisherman and the hunter to pay for everything in conservation. And this is going on a national basis. Karen, I think you're quite well aware of it, involved in it, and others around the table too, is that this is where we're going to have to go. Okay, we can't keep just raising the fishing license fee or the hunting license fee or the combo fee. So certainly that's going to be a big part of what we do also, as we are then also working with our legislators, asking their help and direction as we go forward.
Help them understand what our funding needs are.
Funding needs are, yeah. And where we're going to have to go that is not traditional.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's face it, I mean, Texas Parks and Wildlife and most conservation in this country has been on the backs of the fishermen and the hunter. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about it from a funding point of view.
Mr. Chairman, I think we're looking for direction from the commission as to where to go next. I do believe the staff consensus is that we would be wise to spend the next several months talking with those constituents you just described, visiting with our legislators and the folks that support us downtown, and then coming back to the commission later this year with some specific recommendations. We believe that's one of the options that's the most palatable and would give us the opportunity to seek out that feedback we just talked about.
But clearly you want to go into the legislative session with the support of the legislative leadership, with our constituents behind us, and the strategy that they all believe is appropriate and supportable. So that's the end target. How we get there is we all have roles in that we need to play.
And with their input.
Absolutely.
That gives us,
Mr. Chairman, what is Commissioner Montgomery, do we have a fee on our paddling trail? Have we ever thought about that?
We've been talking about it.
You and I
the question that comes up is whether it's a license fee for boats and for canoes and kayaks and whether it's promoted.
But then all part of our
card to do it at the site at the
trail.
Right. Park does support it. We like running a park. I spend more to staff and collectively.
Chairman, yes. Can you explain to me the federal excise tax in the loop on how we get money from that?
It's a 3-to-1 match in both. There's a sport fish restoration and wildlife restoration fund, federal fund, which comes from the sale of sporting goods. That tax is allocated to states according to a formula of the numbers of hunters and anglers you have in those states. And clearly, Texas, we always get the maximum because we're one of the largest states. So for every state dollar we spend, we can be reimbursed up to $3 to that maximum amount, and we get that maximum amount. But we have to expend those dollars, all of those dollars. That's what Scott was talking about. We have to expend $100 in order to get the $75 back. It's a reimbursement type situation.
There's
a federal excise tax.
There's particularly two different funds, Dingell Johnson and Pittman Robertson. Any rifle, any firearm sold, there's an 11% tax, Pittman Robertson tax. All ammunition that is sold, reloading equipment that is sold, there's an 11% tax on that, federal tax, that goes into U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service into Washington and is appropriated back to the states on a reimbursement basis based on number of hunters, 100 days, you know, those kinds of things. Texas is number one in what we receive. I think the combined PRDJ, Dingell Johnson, and fishery, same way, fishing equipment, lures, rods, reels, all of those kinds of things. People pay a federal excise tax. It comes back to the states for fish and wildlife conservation. And I believe our combined reimbursement estimated this year is around $25, $26 million to Texas. So it's truly a user, a constituent, you know, participating in conserving those resources, managing those resources, and it's very directed. The feds, quite frankly, and justifiably so, are very protective of how that money is spent. We can't spend it on certain things at Parks and Wildlife. Right? We can only spend it on fish and wildlife approved fish and wildlife restoration projects. Conservation project. So there's some strings attached to it, but it is truly a constituent user pay program.
And
we combine that with the revenues from our hunting and fishing licenses to fund these agencies that we're talking about, these divisions that we're talking about.
Now, do they also determine what is taxed? Is it only ammunition and rifles?
Yes. Very specific.
It's very specific. Federal excise, yes.
Very specific.
And within the last 3 months, we've been in conversations with the most senior leadership at U.S. Fish and Wildlife. They've started an initiative to try to create a new taxing bill that would tax other wildlife users. For example, maybe binoculars would be taxed, and that money might come back to the state, similar to PR and DJ. It's just in the initial stages of discussion. It's not going to happen quick because it's a federal project. But this discussion is going on at the federal level, the same discussion we're having here. How are you going to get other users for the outdoors to pay a fair share of conservation efforts out there?
But what percentage of sporting goods tax are we taking now?
From state?
The original sporting goods tax was originally designed.
Now, there's an estimated.
Just about.
You mean for parks?
5% about them?
Yeah.
I would like to ask us to look at the possibilities, discuss the possibility of dedicating some percentage of that tax. That would index with inflation, and in theory, it's a broad-based tax that does tie user benefit to user fee, which was the original theory.
Well, right now, that's a Fund 64. Yeah. I'm not saying we couldn't go have the discussion, but that sporting goods sales tax was... The argument was it was intended to fund state parks activities, recreational activities in state parks. Mr. Cook said, at least from the Fed's perspective, you got to be careful how you mix those two activities. In fact, you can't really do that, or you're going to lose that federal funding.
I understand what I was thinking, though. If we're only using a small percentage, we are also funding other recreational activities. In fact, we have this other fund. It's a logical, legitimate argument to me that it should fund both things.
Potentially stay in the same fund, but just incremental challenge.
Mm-hmm. Philosophy breaks up very quickly when you start dealing with politics. I'm not saying we ought to look at
it. No, I think we're going to that.
Philosophically, I agree. Well, remember the last legislature did ask that the commission be put together, a subcommittee, I don't know what terms, the right term, to study the sporting goods tax what's in it. For example, we were laughing about what is it, pogo sticks are in there, but canoes are not. Okay, right. This maybe gets to you that that may end up, mm-hmm. if we ever get that group put together, which hadn't happened yet to my knowledge. As
no.
Okay. We're supposed to have that together and report back to the legislature by January of 2009. Is that you may be able to broaden its scope eventually. I don't think this round, but the next round, and see where those dollars, because as we know, those dollars are being collected but have not been used in the state parks, not at the full level.
I think the real important distinction here is that tax on sporting goods in Texas is a sales tax.
Yes.
It's on everything.
Good point.
Federal excise tax is specific to firearms, ammunition. It's put on there. 1939, those programs have been in for 60, 70 years now. Specific to those identified items, those specifically identified items only pay. Those are the only things you pay that 11% tax on. Whereas the state tax in Texas is the sales tax. It's on
every. The different types of taxes is what I think, yeah.
Huge advantage of having something like that.
Yeah. Oh, of course. The way you mean the way it's set up. No, that's right. Well, yeah, and it is raising. Gosh, I don't know, $100+ million a year. Am I saying that correctly? Or is that biennium? I can't remember. I think it's a year. So there's a lot of dollars there that right now have been not appropriated to parks or anything else that's due to conservation. So you could broaden the scope. There's no doubt about it. And eventually, my guess is that discussion will get started, maybe even with this committee is trying to be put together to the point. I think Lieutenant Governor is supposed to nominate some people, Speaker of the House, and the Governor.
Yes. Has the Speaker nominated, on the outside, have they made any nominations on that?
I don't.
Yeah. I think the Speaker's side, but not the Lieutenant Governor's side.
Okay. So the Senate side, we don't have.
Okay. Bob, one last question regarding this. On some of the federal laws, you can get exemptions. I know that you can on the health care side. Can there be can we request an exemption on items regarding the FRITS tax at the federal level? Or has that ever been looked at to see if other items could be added within our state as an exemption of federal law?
I honestly don't recall. I'm sure that it has. There's been every kind of angle looked at through time. Yeah, Mike Berger was involved directly in the program in D.C. Can Mike?
Well, when this thing started, it was sporting arms and ammunition, and over time things have been added. I mean, handguns were added; they were not in it originally, so it was a handgun tax. Archery equipment's been added over years to increase that tax, and then there was the foreign imports that got added and a tax collected on them. So our manufacturers wouldn't be at a competitive disadvantage. So there are things that have been added. I think the same thing, Dingell Johnson started just with fishing equipment, but then you got Wallop Bro in there, which put motorboat fuel tax and other items on there that was available for fishing and how the money split up. I mean, there's a lot of rules to that. But, yeah, there's the ability to expand things. But as Bob said, I think you have to be careful what you ask for expanding to, and it has to be, I think, pertinent to the purpose for which the funds would be used. And I think where they're going now is trying to find a new source of revenue that would fund basically non-game and those kinds of outdoor activities. We tried that back in the 1970s, and it's been tried through the teaming with wildlife process for a number of years, and it's a slow, slow process. We are getting money through the teaming with wildlife process called state wildlife grants to the tune of our share is about $3 million a year. But, I mean, that's just a small portion of what the need is. But that has to be funded annually, so it's never certain, but it's funded annually out of the general U.S. appropriations, whereas if this was a dedicated fund like PR and DJ, it would be better. But the manufacturers, as I recall, I mean, all the conservation groups who are users would support these additional taxes. But when you go to the manufacturer, generally they say, hey, a number of reasons. Well, our film is used for sporting events and family portraits, and so don't tax our film, and our binoculars are used for sporting events and other things, so don't, it's not just wildlife, and it makes it hard to, and nobody wants no new taxes either, so.
Actually, the news may have a hard time saying it.
Yeah.
But no, but you're making a good point. I mean, there's plenty.
This car right here.
I've got my back one there.
It was a canoe paddle.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I appreciate that for the questions. I want to kind of summarize a couple of things. One is from this recommendation from our task force looking at it, you know, we had started out with the idea of going at a fee increase soon this spring. But after we looked at that issue, our recommendation back to you is let's pull back that for a second. When we look, for example, very easily, what happened in 04 when we went through that fee increase, we passed a fee increase in the same kind of process. When it came to the time for the legislature to appropriate that, the economic situation was not good, similar to what we're talking about now. The changes in the legislature membership and leadership there, and what happened was that money wasn't appropriated to us. Yet our users paid for those fees and continue to pay, but they expected those programs that we couldn't afford to pay. That's not the model we want to use. And in this case, we really have issues we've got to deal with. We do need to deal with these now. We cannot afford that. We are going to have to look at fee increases as part of this model. I mean, in all honesty, our licenses are still a bargain. You get a tremendous amount for it. It needs to be part of that mix. So we have a window of opportunity here for us to sit down with those constituents and the legislative leadership and build that support and look at the various options we can look at and move forward with a comprehensive package that can really deal with this. We've got that option to do, and it certainly is the best thing for us to do.
And that's the direction you're going to go.
Well, we're seeking your guidance on that.
I think we're directing you to go.
That's right. What I'm seeking, Mr. Chairman, of the Finance Committee is
yes.
That and that board. And we all, as we said, we all have a role in that. Our new executive director, you all, and the staff. And we've got some opportunities with some new organizations of conservation groups that have come together to help park, but they're there. And certainly the legislative leadership, we're in contact with them. So the elements are all there. We just have to put them together in a way that makes sense and works for us.
I think we're asking you to go forward with that plan. Good. Any other questions?
I want to thank Larry, Scott, too, but Dr. McKinney's really done a lot of work on this. And it's a complex issue. The first is the detail of wading through the numbers, and then the complexity of then how do we go forward. And I think it's going to take some real work as we all think through this. So I'm going to ask the commission to think about it and bring all your resources to the table. And one of the reasons I bring that up is there's some real frustration out there with the hunter and fishermen. As they carry more and more of the load and yet don't feel they're getting a return for the bucks they're putting in it. It's still a very fair price relative to the license. I don't disagree with that, but I think of it, not think, I know we're going to have to expand or broaden where we get those dollars, okay? And that's going to take some work, but I think what we want to focus on as we go into January of 2009 is starting that process. And as you said, I think a lot of the conservation groups are ready to move forward, but now we've got to work through everything from legislators to manufacturers to everybody else's agenda. And that's going to be a big part of what we are going to try to do. And I've asked Larry and Scott and others to start looking at it from that point of view.
Very good.
That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Doc. Good job.
Committee item number 7, advisory committee rules, and we're asking permission to public and Bright to make a presentation.
Good morning, commissioners. For the record, I'm Ann Bright, general counsel, and this one actually should be fairly simple. The Parks and Wildlife Code authorizes the commission chairman to appoint advisory committees. Also, Chapter 2110 of the government code says that if an agency has advisory committees, it has to follow certain requirements. One of them is adoption of rules. There has to be an annual evaluation of the advisory committee, the presiding officer of a committee selected by the members. There's a limit of 24 members, and there's a four-year life to each advisory committee unless it's extended by rule. Back in 2005, the commission adopted rules regarding advisory committees. That was is the result of a deadline that was actually set in the government code. Among the committees that were created were three that we're going to be talking about today: the Game Bird Advisory Committee, the Texas Quail Council, and the Operation Game Thief Committee. In looking at this, we a little bit more carefully, I think we've determined that the Operation Game Thief Committee is probably not really truly an advisory committee. That's created by statute. They manage the Operation Game Thief Fund and make death benefit payments and reward payments. We're recommending that we repeal that. We also have some other rules specifically regarding the operation of the Operation Game Thief Committee. Also, for accuracy, we're recommending that we replace the Game Bird Advisory Board with the Migratory Game Bird Advisory Committee and replace the Texas Quail Council with the Upland Game Bird Advisory Committee. We recommend that the proposed changes be published in the Texas Register, and we would come back to you in March to request adoption. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Texas Quail Council, for example, are the members of that council going to have the opportunity to serve on the Upland Game Bird Advisory Committee, or how is that exactly going to be handled?
That's going to be up to the chairman.
I've already heard about some things. And actually, I'm going to go back into this. To answer your question, yes, most were, but not all. Okay. I've got some conversations going on now, and in fact, Scott and I are going to visit sometime in the next couple of days, relative to particularly the quail situation, which obviously is a hot button for a lot of people throughout the state. And it being folded up in Upland Game Bird Advisory Committee, I think is still the right thing to do. You can see what we've tried to do here is we create a migratory and then an upland game. And that seems to me to make sense. But I think that we have maybe a standing subcommittee under Upland Game focused directly on quail. So it's a discussion I'm in now. I've got some constituents, obviously, they're very interested in quail, say the least. And some of them were on the Quail Council or the Quail Technical, what was the other one? Technical Committee that have called me, and with legitimate worries and issues, and I think so I'm still visiting that particular one. Does that help answer your question, Mark?
Right. There was some panhandle representation on the Quail Council also, and they were concerned.
So fair enough from there, and South Texas also got it. Yeah.
I mean, as you say, it's a statewide concern.
Very much so, and certainly turkeys are the other one. But I don't hear as much on the turkey side, I think, because we've done a lot of good work and people are seeing that increase again spread throughout more counties. Whereas the quail is still where I think a lot of people feel we have a real chance to stop the degradation of both habitat and the bird itself. And a lot of people really have a great interest in it. So I think I want to keep tapping into that somehow. So maybe we'll make a standing subcommittee under Upland or do something like that. Long-winded answer, but anyway.
To just mimic what Mark is saying, I have personally, as I don't know about the rest of the commission, but I've had many, many phone calls about this rearrangement. We had the Texas Quail Council that had always, they did a remarkable job. And underneath that, under the umbrella, we had the technical committee. And that technical committee was comprised of 24 of the brightest minds with regard to quail that are in the state of Texas, including a lot of our staff biologists, as well as out of the A&M system, the Caesar Clayburgh Wildlife Research Institute, the West Texas group was well represented on that technical committee. And I want to tell you, there are a lot of people really upset over this realignment. They realize they're quite aware of the successes that had been made during the past years of that operation. And then to shrink that into Upland Game Bird Advisory Committee of 24 people, and obviously you're going to have to leave out some of those minds and do away with, totally do away with, the technical committee, which is leaving out the brightest educated minds. I think we really need to be careful before we go forward with this thing, because you know, I've received a lot of phone calls and a lot of people are unhappy about it.
I think what we're doing though is just asking to publish this in the Texas Register, and then we'll seek a lot of public comment on the whole issue. And so that's what we're trying to do.
Which I certainly am going to encourage, and ask you, John and Mark, everybody, to encourage their constituents to do that. And I very much have an open mind on this. The one issue, just so you'll be aware, that I do have an issue with, if we go to a subcommittee or standing committee or whatever we end up deciding, is that it got too large. That was an issue. And so I want to make sure that we have a very focused group. My guess is maybe a good way to go would be some kind of balance between landowners, habitat focus, and some scientists and expertise. But it got too big. It got unwieldy, and it tended to kind of meander around a lot those last couple of years. So I'm trying to get this thing in a more focused position. Maybe we do that, and we just find the right way. Well, not maybe. We will do that. We've got to find the right way to do that. So I'm in complete agreement with everybody else.
Oh, good point. Are there any further questions for Ann? If not, I will authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Next item is item number 8, Internet Sales of Big Time Texas Hunt. Permission, we're asking permission to publish. And it's Darcy Bontempo.
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Darcy Bontempo. I'm the Marketing Director for the Department, and I'm here before you this morning to seek permission to publish two proposed rule amendments to Big Time Texas Hunt, and actually regarding Internet sales, which I think dovetails quite nicely into some of the discussion that happened during Deputy Director Gene McCarty's presentation. First, I'd like to give a little bit of background. There are a number of new commissioners. So just briefly, Big Time Texas Hunts has been a successful revenue-generating program for the department for almost 10 years. It actually was launched in 96, and it has been generating significant revenue for the last almost 10 years. The program itself gives hunters an opportunity to buy a $10 entry to win one of 7 premium hunt packages. Last year, the program resulted in more than $798,000 in gross revenue, with about 20,000 hunters participating, each buying about an average of 4 entries. And the revenue generated from this program goes to fund a number of things, wildlife research, habitat management, and also public hunting opportunities. Again, I'm here before you today regarding the to seek permission. As you know, it's required by Parks and Wildlife Code 11.0271 for the commission is required to set any fees for participation. That's why I'm here this morning. And specifically, I'm seeking permission to publish the following proposed rule amendments in the Texas Register. First, I'm seeking permission to authorize the sale of entries for the Big Time Texas Hunts at $9 if they're purchased online. So that's about a 10% discount to the $10 entry price that has been charged and will continue to be charged with the other purchase methods, which are direct mail or over the phone or at a retailer. In addition, I'm seeking permission to authorize the collection of a convenience fee, a $5 convenience fee that was mentioned earlier, that's consistent with what is charged when people go online. And just to be clear, what that means is it's for a shopping trip visit online. So if you go and you buy, in this case, I think I mentioned 4 entries is the average number of entries. With this price promotion, they would buy 4 entries at $9 plus a $5 convenience fee for all of those items. No matter, they could also buy their hunting license at the same time, and they would be charged just $5 once for that shopping trip. So just want to make sure that's clear. And again, that is consistent with what we're charging for other license fees online. The reason we're seeking this is we think there'll be some benefits. First off, with this price promotion, we think we're going to attract more participants at that price point. and that's going to obviously result in greater sales. This type of promotion gives us an opportunity to actually go online and do for the first time some real pushes on hunting-related websites with a call to action, actually linking to purchase. And in fact, what's been so successful about Big Time Texas Hunts is when we moved in 98 to direct mail, which gave people the option to purchase at that time. In other words, a direct response vehicle. And so this online promotion is similarly a direct response vehicle. And so we believe that it's going to result in also greater out-of-state sales, as well as giving us an opportunity to reach some hunters we haven't been able to do to reach in the past in a cost-effective way. And additionally, it's a maturing program, so it will give us a news peg, which is always looked for when you have maturing programs. It's some news. Further, as came up in the discussions in the presentation regarding license sales, it gives us an opportunity to increase some overall awareness of online purchase option. We're just beginning to feel comfortable with aggressively marketing online purchasing now that we feel secure that we've got a system that is stable. And so this is a kind of a strategy, if you will, to do that. It's not the primary reason why we're doing it, but this is another benefit. Right now, about 9% of all Big Time Texas Hunt sales are sold online. And that compares to about 2%, as you heard earlier, for other licenses here for Parks and Wildlife. But that is below other states that have automated systems, which they average about 5%. Retail sales in general average about 5%. Obviously, it varies depending on the type of product. Computers and software is up at 40%. But, you know, we think there's room to grow, and so this is, gives us another opportunity to do that. And it gives us an opportunity, if we're doing business online with customers, we're going to be able to hopefully market to them online, and that is an extremely cost-effective way to market. When you look at what we're spending for printing and postage costs and how those continue to escalate, this gives us an opportunity to develop an online relationship, a marketing relationship with these customers, and we're going to be looking at, if this is approved, encouraging our online customers who buy Big Time Texas entries to for email reminders so we can capture their email and basically market to them next year rather than mail them. So that's another opportunity that this would afford us. So with your permission, we would post these two proposed rule changes on the Texas Public Register, and then pending, you know, comments, we would then seek to adopt both of those in the March commission meeting. And, of course, pending approval, if that was approved, we would also include those changes in the 2009 Outdoor Annual. And that concludes my presentation, and I'd be very happy to answer any questions.
Do you have a targeted growth rate on your Internet percentages?
Well, I think we'd like to get in line with the other states, as I mentioned. So I think, you know, I mean, I'd like to see us get up to 5% in the next year or two.
And we're currently at what, 2%?
2% overall, as I mentioned. Again, with lottery, Big Time Texas Hunt is a lottery product, so it's a higher. It has 9%, but we could be doing better in that regard as well. And I think that it's a very convenient method for a lot of our customers, and this gives gives us an opportunity to let them know that there is, you know, we do have that purchase option available to them should they choose to do that.
Darcy and maybe Scott and Mike too. One of the things I was just talking to Bob about was you've got roughly 20,000 entries. Am I saying that correctly?
Yes, sir.
700.
Well, 20,000 participants, 80,000 roughly.
No, that's right. Actually, 20,000 participants.
Yes, sir.
So 20,000 participants for 7 hunts.
Yes, sir.
What I'd like to look into is can we expand the hunts?
Well, we actually are looking into possibly expanding the hunts. I mean, there is a question, and we always look at cannibalization. We look at the fact that there's a share of wallet issue, and, you know, there's a certain amount of money that is going to be spent. And you just have to look at the increased costs. As you offer more hunts, you will incur more costs. And so you have to be sure that you're actually going to grow the overall contribution from those hunters. And that's always something that we look at very carefully. But we are looking at... and I don't know if Mike wants to speak to this at all, or regarding the we're looking at the possibility. It's a little premature, maybe. But we're looking at the possibility of a new hunt that might actually bring more sales than an existing hunt. So maybe replacing some hunts that we think might have more revenue possibilities.
We are looking at new ways to new hunt possibilities out there. I would say in the past, as to what Darcy was talking about, that when this program started, we had a the whitetail bonanza, which started as 10 buck hunts that would be drawn, and the first year of that was outstanding. I mean, we just got lots of entries for those 10 hunts, and as I recall, we said, this is so good, let's offer 20 hunts. And so we went on the line and bought 20 hunts to raffle, and we got the same number of entries. So we said, all right, we doubled our expenses and didn't increase our income, so we went back to 10, and we've been carrying it that way. So what Darcy's talking about with cannibalism is right. I mean,
I'm glad you brought that up.
We don't know if there's a threshold that people are buying. Was it four entries per individual? And whether they, with a new hunt, whether it would go to 4.2 or 4.5 or not, we don't know. And I guess we won't know until we really put something out there and try it out.
Yeah, and maybe, as you said, a different mix or different
types
of hunts or all the above.
Right. Yeah, looking at...
Maybe you mix them up every third year or something, too. But also, remember, I'd like to think about tying this into just expanding the opportunities for people to be able to hunt to our public. And I've got to believe longer term, as we encourage that, then maybe, you know, you make lull for a while and then it picks up. I'm like you, I'm not an expert anymore, but I'd certainly like to balance the dollars we're trying to create, and I understand net dollars, not just gross dollars,
with
more hunting opportunities for the public.
Exactly. And the money, I was going to say, the money we raise does go to buy public hunting opportunities. We're trying to keep this, that's the challenge, is to make sure the first issue is this is a revenue generating program, and so as long as we can be effective at really choosing, and I agree with you, looking at some new hunts and creating some news, making sure that the different kinds of hunters have products, if you will, that appeal to them, I think that that's going to be the best way to generate revenue that then can be used to add to public hunting opportunities.
And speaking of that, I mean, for example, has the 20,000 been flat for a while? Has it been growing from some number over the last 4 or 5 years?
It's been pretty flat for quite a while. I would want to say 5 or 6 years. It's been pretty flat. And it is a matured product, and you see that with the lottery in general. I mean,
we went out a couple of years ago in trying to expand this market and looked at buying some. We did buy some magazine advertising and I guess some higher and lower end hunting magazines, outdoor magazines, to see what we got in. And as I recall, it wasn't worth the investment to do that out of state or try to.
I wanted to survey.
We didn't have online.
Surveys would maybe help or something to some of your people that are blind.
I think,
I'm just trying to think of ideas of how we.
Right.
I think that the online advertising that we're going to be looking at doing this year is because we now are, like I said, are comfortable looking at some kind of online, aggressively marketing online, especially if we decide and it's agreed to do a price promotion. That's going to be a real opportunity. I know I think Colorado with their elk hunt has about 60% of their entries coming from out of state. I mean, so there's some opportunities for us to drive direct response online, and I'm real interested in trying to build that. I think it offers a great opportunity for us.
And I think that the quality is what helps drive it. It's not the quantity so much as the quality.
No, and I don't disagree with that. And I think then somehow we've got to figure out how to reach out to that constituency and find out what they want going forward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of retail thought processes and how we keep this thing fresh.
Okay. Right.
And we certainly can look at, to your point, incorporating, working with wildlife, whatever, to incorporate some questions where it's possible that we can add to existing surveys, not a whole nother, a new effort, but something where we can maybe look into that.
So it might, you know, create a hook for somebody that hadn't done it before. Okay.
Right. Have you all looked at a fishing equivalent of this?
Yes, sir, we have, and that was many years ago, and the challenge there, and we work closely with coastal and inland fisheries, and both Larry Ann McKinley and Phil DeRocher, and the issue there is that it's a less expensive prize to win, no matter what you put in there. We pick the best lodge, and we put the best package together. But it just doesn't have the appeal. We looked at a $5, we looked at a $10. We just could not raise enough money to justify the direct mail costs that were required to try to generate response. So now who knows? Down the road with email, with online marketing, we might look at it again. If the costs of fulfilling it come down, particularly in terms of the marketing area, there may be an opportunity for us to look at that again. But it was cost prohibitive before. Is that anything you want to add?
Any further discussion or questions? If no further questions or discussion, I will authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Committee item number 9, local park grant rule amendments mandated by legislative House Bill 12. Tim Hoxett.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. I'm Tim Hoxett from Recreation Grants Branch in the State Parks Division. We're returning this morning from the November permission to publish that you gave us with today and tomorrow, seeking your final approval of new and changed grant rules. The programs that we have reviewed through this process include the ones up on the screen: outdoor, indoor, community outdoor outreach, regional park grants, small community grants, the newly created urban park grant program that I'll talk about in some detail later. And we also took a look at the two federally funded opportunities that we have, boating access and trail grants. The process began immediately after the last legislative session closed. That's the primary reason that we need to make new rules, is with increased funding and changes based on legislation. We did a staff retreat. We did a statewide survey. We then held 5 public hearings around the state. Over 200 people attended, registered attendance at those public hearings. For the Urban Park Grant Program, newly established by the legislature, we held a summit meeting of the leadership of the 13 eligible applicants under that program. Basically, those are the cities and counties of population of 500,000 or more. So we felt like it was important to bring them to the table and establishing new rules and new scoring systems for those programs to get their direct input. You then gave us permission to publish, and we published the draft rules that we've created for all of these programs in the Texas Register in December. And we've received only 4 comments. I'll give you a little detail about those at the end. The reason for these changes are increased appropriations and the fact that House Bill 12 amends Chapter 24 of the Parks and Wildlife Code to partition our grant assistance into 2 different accounts. The traditional Texas Recreation and Parks account will now be available for communities of populations of 500,000 and less. And then the new Urban Park Grant Program is created. It's technically called the Large Municipality Account. That will be 40% of the available sporting goods tax revenues for grants available to the 13 largest communities in the state: Austin, Dallas, Fort Worth, Houston, San Antonio, and El Paso. The county governments in which those reside for a total of 12, plus Hidalgo County in the Rio Grande Valley, which is the McAllen area. Again, that's a set-aside of 60% going into the smaller communities in the state of 500,000 or less that they compete among themselves for and only among themselves for, and 40% going into this urban park account that the 13 largest communities compete only among themselves for. We looked at, in all of these programs, the priority ranking systems that we use. In the case of the Urban Park Grant Program, we were obviously required to create new priority ranking system proposals, and we also looked at our administrative rules and practices. Going through program by program, I'll try to be brief on these. The major administrative changes that we're talking about making and requesting your permission to make in the Outdoor Recreation Grant Program, the traditional program that's that part of that 60% money available for the smaller communities of the state, we're proposing, due to increased funding available, to go back to 2 annual award cycles, with January 31 and July 31st being the 2 annual application deadlines. And we're proposing to increase the maximum amount of the grants that we would award from $400,000 in 50% match to a $500,000 match. That would bring us back in line where we were in 2002 and 2003, before the 2 successive legislative sessions where our appropriations authority was reduced. Yes, sir.
I think it's in the Outdoor Recreation Grant. If you ask a question, if it's not, you can punt it.
Okay.
here where you're talking about your scoring changes. You're talking about scoring from the TPW Land and Water Conservation Plan. Personally, to the extent the rest of the commission agrees, it seems to me that what we want to do as part of the Land and Water Plan is create sustainable activities which encourage conservation. You've got recreational sports, birding, nature tourism, other things where you create revenue streams for communities and get them to sponsor activity, which is ongoing, doesn't require continuing governmental funding, but does then encourage conservation by creating value and resource. Is that the theory, or can that be the theory? Can we tighten that down so that's the real driving theory behind that, as opposed to just broadly saying Land and Water Plan, which could be full of it?
We are adding that criteria really in sort of a test mode at this point to all of the scoring systems. And it's not a lot of points at this point. We're proposing a couple of points for them to address in a narrative fashion in their application how they feel that the activity or the project that they're going to do specifically relates to the Land and Water Plan. And that's both from a perspective of the natural resource and conservation piece of the plan, but also a very big portion of that plan speaks directly to the need for assistance, state assistance going to local governments for outdoor recreation and indoor recreation opportunity. I think we'll see how what kind of responses we get from that, and maybe with your guidance in future, increase the priority for that.
Yeah, given the mission of the agency, and again, I don't know the legislative intent as well as you do, or nor the public comment or the other criteria, so I'm speaking a bit of a vacuum here, but personal preference would be to heavily weight that activity to the extent it promotes sustainable conservation and outdoor recreation uses consistent with the Land and Water Plan. I'd like to get a heavy weight. And I think it's fits the mission of the agency and creates an active ongoing constituency.
That's it. I understand, and that's the spirit in which we're doing this. It's also the spirit in which we're doing some increases in things like the fourth item here on this list, increasing the number of points related to environmentally responsible projects, things like green construction, habitat restoration, things that are going to be natural resource conservation kinds of things.
I don't believe there's been any resistance to us taking that path from the legislature. There's been support for that, so I think we're okay there to put more emphasis there, Commissioner.
Even under the old system, the projects that, for example, that you'll look at tomorrow in the outdoor recreation projects, usually the more conservation at land acquisition, for example, and the more conservation oriented projects have tended to rise to the top in the scoring system. But we, in our public hearings in particular, made a pretty big deal out of that we are a part of Parks and Wildlife, and that, you know, our mission is more than just providing outdoor and indoor recreation opportunities at a local level, but that we make sure that the conservation and natural resource issues are addressed.
Just to drill down, this specific thing for me would be sustainable use by people that create revenue streams and economic basis
okay.
in these communities that tie back to our plan.
Okay. We don't have anything that directly ties to that, I don't think, in this scoring system. But I think that's the direction in general. Other things that we're proposing to change or tweak a bit in this outdoor recreation grant scoring system, decrease points related to the budget that's proposed in the area of traditionally, we've said we put more emphasis on projects that ask for more money for actual parks and recreation facilities, ball fields as opposed to restrooms, for example. What we were told pretty consistently in our public hearings was that, yes, we understand that emphasis, and we want you to continue to reward that, but we'd like you to back off a little bit on that because you still have to have those other infrastructure items to do an effective park facility. So we're going to recommend decreasing slightly that percentage and the award based on of additional points based on the percentage of that budget. We were asked to increase the priority of renovation projects. just as the state park system has aging infrastructure, most of the parks and recreation municipal systems have aging infrastructure. And not that they've not been responsible with their use of their money, but simply don't have the local ability always to update that. So we've been asked to allow the renovation projects be more competitive. And finally, we're proposing to have a 5-point negative score based on sponsors that aren't in compliance with previously funded projects. We go out and do periodic post-completion inspections of every park that we've ever funded. That's several thousand parks around the state. And as we find problems, lack of maintenance or conversion of part of the park land for other purposes, as we find issues with them, we work through those with them. But we feel like that ought to, in some manner, count against you if you're asking for a new park grant. And so we got a lot of support for this in the public hearings, that we penalize folks in terms of the negative score if they're not taking care of existing facilities. Indoor recreation grant changes. Basically, we're proposing to go back to where we were in terms of funding ceiling, again, to the benchmark of when we were receiving full appropriations authority from the legislature in 2003, from $400,000 to $750,000 and 50% match for those kinds of projects. The indoor recreation grant scoring changes are actually are identical to the outdoor, just different kind of facility. Small community grant program are grants of 50% matching grants to communities of 50,000 population or less. They're up to 20,000 population or less. They're currently up to $50,000 grants. We are proposing to increase that match ceiling to $75,000. That program has been very, very popular with small communities. The scoring system for that program, we're proposing to increase slightly the number of points to very, very small communities, communities of 2,500 or less, to make them more competitive in this subset program. We're proposing to delete the diversity recreation scoring criteria. Basically, that was giving points for the more kinds of opportunities that you asked for in your project, the more points you got. What we heard from the small communities was that really limits us from being able to do a single purpose, maybe just a ball field or just a playground or something like that. Again, showing up the award points, additional points for environmentally responsible activities, the link to the land and water plan, and then the negative scoring criteria based on noncompliance. Community outdoor outreach grants are non-match required grants of up to $30,000 for activities and programs related to getting underserved populations into the outdoors. Specifically, we target youth and minority and handicap and other kinds of groups that traditionally may not have had the opportunity to participate in outdoor recreation activities. And we try to focus those folks towards our facilities where we can. The increase in award would be contingent upon, this is a little quirk in the Legislative Appropriations Act that was passed for us. There is a specific rider that tells us how much we are supposed to spend on an annual basis for the Community Outdoor Outreach Grant Program. Why that continues to exist, I'm not sure, but it does. And it was not, as increased funding came back from sporting goods sales tax, the amount of that rider was not adjusted accordingly. This benchmark of $480,000 annually that we had available for that program in the last biennium was not adjusted to where it would have been in light of the overall adjustment at about $1,250,000 annually. I hope that makes sense. So we have asked, the agency has made a request to the Legislative Budget Board to correct what we think was an oversight in that process. if they see that favorably, then we would like to increase the award ceiling on these kinds of grants back to where it was again when we suspended the, when the program took funding cuts subsequent to 2003. The only scoring change that we're recommending for that program is adding points for projects that relate to environmentally conservation groups, service projects, projects like AmeriCorps would do or like a Boy Scout troop might do. The Recreation Trails federal grant program, we're just suggesting tweaking of application deadline for staff purposes. That program also requires a set aside of 30% of these federal funds for motorized and the rest for non-motorized. We're suggesting for the non-motorized kinds of trails, traditional walking, hiking trails, that we increase the award ceilings for those from $100,000 to $200,000, and that was based on customer input. Boating access, we're simply suggesting a change in the annual application deadline. The Urban Park Grant Program, the 40% that was carved out for the communities of $500,000 or more. The scoring criteria that we're proposing to you are in three significant areas, first being land acquisition. We would propose that land acquisition projects be given priority, which involves significant natural areas, which involve green corridors, providing connectivity to existing protected areas, projects that acquire land for small pocket parks within communities, acquisition of land for intensive use recreation facilities would receive priority. Future conservation and recreation purposes, land that would essentially be bought now while it's available with the idea that in the future it would be available for needed conservation or development purposes. Expansion of existing parks, and then finally the acquisition in areas of high population, high density population park facilities. Facility development priorities, we're proposing neighborhood parks be a priority, nature centers, parks and conservation areas of regional significance where there are partnerships involved, projects that involve development with green construction and sustainability, facility development of sports facilities, outdoor aquatic education, recreation facilities, pools, etc., restoration of existing infrastructure, and then priority to projects that involve both wildlife and other habitat restoration. Other issues in the scoring system, public and public-private cooperation in terms of the match. The more of the match that came from outside sources other than from these large communities' treasuries. Priority to projects that meet needs of underserved populations, priority to a sponsor that has a local parks and recreation master plan in place, priority to projects that reduce the threat to a piece of property that might not be publicly available should the community not act, buying land while it's available or through threat of development or expansion of non-park infrastructure. Giving priority to, again, projects meeting the goals and narrating towards how they're meeting the goals of the Land and Water Plan. And then adding, we've got a unique opportunity, we think, here in that we've got a strong urban biology program in the Wildlife Division and that we've got representatives of those in each of the areas of these urban communities. Giving some additional credit for consultations from a planning standpoint of what these parks are going to look like with our urban biology staff and starting that at an early point when the idea of the genesis of the project begins, and then giving them some priority points for having done that. Indoor urban park grants, priority for development of nature centers, green construction, multi-purpose traditional kinds of indoor recreation facilities, and then restoration of existing facilities. And then the other issues in this criteria, identical to those in the urban outdoor program. We did receive four comments as part of the Texas Register process. I won't take much time with these, but want to get them on the record. One comment related to how difficult our legalese, the language of the rules, were to understand. Unfortunately, that's sort of the nature of the beast, and posting in the Texas Register, it is a very technical process. We received a couple of consultants said that they were concerned about our scoring criteria for master plans, giving priority in most of the systems that we have for projects related to a locally adopted Parks and Recreation master plan. We're going to attempt to clarify how we do that based on these comments. The rest of the comments were really mainly just asking for clarification of what we meant in specific areas, and we're going to endeavor to make sure that we, as we do the final posting of these, clarify those points. Really was no opposition as a result of any of the criteria, any of the Texas Register postings that we got. With that, we'll be asking you tomorrow to hopefully adopt this resolution. And I'd be glad to answer questions.
And modify what I asked before, which is, I think as I hear all these, everything except indoor and outreach programs, indoor, maybe with outreach, I would like with the commission at least to increase the weighting as we discussed of those variables. We didn't quite close the loop on that.
Okay. Would you want us to do that now?
Please.
Okay. Do you have a suggestion? The land and water plan, what we were testing was the idea of a couple of points. And
suggestion for points or objective?
Objective is understood. I think I would need to ask if you would want us to change the proposal that's been out there for public comment in terms of how many points we would award for that.
I have to look at it with you. I'm feeling at the policy level, not at the implementation level on that one.
In terms of the weighting, how impactful is that now?
2 points would be a tiebreaker kind of a situation, I would think, more than anything. I don't think that it would be significant enough to be a make or break. And we're talking about just that link to the land and water plan. There are significant numbers of other points in the scoring system that are related to conservation kinds of issues.
I'm really asking about those which create ongoing activity, which create activities for those communities that help create constituencies for conservation, as opposed to just good things that are conservation or green construction, other things that are relatively passive, which creates an active activity consistent with water, land, water.
I guess I need your help understanding how that would work, what that would be.
Well, I'm specifically thinking our nature tourism activities, our paddle trails, our biking programs, the equestrian program, the other programs that we're promoting to create more recreation, birding, the broad spread of nature tourism, which get people out there, create constituencies and economic constituencies in those communities for those activities. Conservation constituencies, if you will.
How would we tie that to a quantifiable score? I'm not sure.
I would think the same way you do any of them, which is that if they do things to help promote those activities, they get points.
Higher weighting is what you're suggesting,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And they currently are.
Okay.
With a more
specific promote those
right.
activities. It's a way of promoting those activities in this community.
I guess then the vehicle for me to do that is this land and water plan criteria.
Which are consistent with the land and water plan criteria.
Goal 1 and 2 specifically. The first two goals, I think.
Those are all in the land and water plan. Those programs are rolling out pursuant to the land and water program.
And we can craft some language that expands on the limited language that we've got now, which was just asking them to narrate how they felt their project met the goals of the land and water plan.
Well,
and I'd be glad to do that. That will be something of a significant change in what's been out there and what's been out in the public participation process. So I'll need to talk with, I guess, folks in legal and determine what our obligations there are. Then the other thing I would need guidance on, I guess, is the relative weighting of what you would want to do.
Let's see if between now and tomorrow we can come up with and what Tim's getting at here. If we change the weighting of this significantly, he may need to go back out to the public.
Yeah, I understand.
And let's see if we can come up with some wording and some emphasis here between now and tomorrow that works. If not, well, we'll see what our other options are.
I'd also suggest that rather than specific program reference at this point, we just put goal one and goal two, I think, are the two goals that are consistent.
Exactly.
So
it's the length.
Right.
It's
a little bit more specificity, but not.
But maybe within the narrow
program.
Yeah. Then the narration you're asking for when they apply is that there's some specific focus on that. Right, exactly. Which I agree, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
That's right, that's what gets the interaction, creates more involvement.
Bob, we still want to place this on the agenda for tomorrow.
I would, and then if we get there, we're fine. If we don't, well, we pull it.
We're really up against a time crunch, honestly, though, because we're going to be needing to take applications for these new systems immediately subsequent to adoption for the next round. We're talking in terms of the urban program, for example. We're doing an April 30th potential deadline for applications. I don't think this is that big of a thing. I guess the guidance that I'm going to need is the relative weighting. I think, you know, 2 points is not much. Maybe range of 5 or 10 would be significant.
Yeah.
Okay. Any further discussion?
No, but okay. I think something in that range moves it from just being a nice thing to something that's really a priority. I'd be happy to look at it. I don't want to presume to design the program for you or for the commission, but I'd be happy to look at it through my comments.
Take a look at it.
Phil, will you work with Tim then? Between now and tomorrow, let's try to craft something working with Ann Bright or whoever else you need to.
Sure.
If there are no further questions or discussion, I will place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Is there any other business be brought before this committee, Mr. Cook?
No, sir.